morning, all. We have an extraordinarily busy day today. We are going to go through all of the bills on the schedule. And
so we can choose the pace we want to go at, but we are scheduled to meet at 4 p.m. and again at 6 p.m. We have specific people scheduled for those times. The bills will be heard in order that they're on right now. Aside from Representative Poppies, because we wanted to make sure that the testifiers were right and lined up, so we will hear that. So with that, Representative Anderson, I know he is here because I talked. Oh yes. Welcome to the committee, Representative Anderson. If you would like to move House File 349 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Good morning, everybody. Yes, I'd like to move House File 349 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. I bring this bill to you because I'm a supporter of ethanol and the good things it's done for Minnesota and I guess also the air we breathe here in Minnesota. And as we try to move to the next level of ethanol blending from E10 to, we also have E85, but the E15 is the next thing that will be coming to us here. There are some financial implications of moving up to these higher blends. The E10 pumpage and things that will not work for E15 currently, and my bill would take money from the Agri Fund, which is what's been left over from the ethanol producer payments that the state has been making over the last few years. Those payments have been finished, and the money that's been left and put in the ag budget, part of it in the Agri Fund, I think this would be a good place to utilize this appropriation for the next couple of years to stimulate and help promote the blender pumps, which is, I think, the best way to go in terms of promoting ethanol and the higher blends of ethanol in our gasoline. Have a couple of testifiers to talk about some of the costs involved with going to blender pumps. Madam Chair, if they could speak now, I'd appreciate it.
Yes. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Toma. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association.
Would you spell your last name for the
T-H-O-M-A.
Thank you.
And I'm here today to talk a little bit about price differentials between E10 equipment and E85 equipment. E85 equipment tends to be a little bit more expensive, about 20%, because of the different materials that have to be used to handle the substance, which is a little bit more corrosive than E10. For instance, a drop tube in a tank for E10 would be about $500, for E85 would be about $1,000. The tank would be about the same price. And, you know, depending upon the manufacturer, a 10,000-gallon tank is about $11,000. The pump that forces the fuel to the multiple product dispenser, when you pull up to the gas station and you go up where the hoses are, that's the what we call the MPD, the multiple product dispenser. The pump that forces that fuel to that point is about $1,500 for an E10 and about $2,300 for E85. The probe that monitors the tank is about $1,100 for E10 and about $1,500 for E85. The MPD is the part that has the most expense in it, and it is the part that also has the most more expense for E85. For MPD that dispenses three products, for E10 it's going to be about $15,000, and one to dispense E85 is going to be about $20,000. With this bill, if we were able to get grants, it would represent about a 20% savings for us on projects, and I think that would be very, very helpful to our members. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any questions. Do you want to bring your next testifier?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Ron Harnick, representing the Minnesota Biofuels Association. Tim Rudnicki, the executive director, got delayed in traffic and not able to be here this morning. So We really thank Representative Anderson for presenting this bill. As we look this last year, we spent several months working on biofuels futures for Minnesota. And in order to really get the biofuels into the marketplace, these blender pumps are really the most appropriate way to do that at this point in time, providing the consumers with a greater opportunity for choice at the pump. These blender pumps will be able to not only deal with E10, E15, E85, but also, as the automobile industry suggests, E30 is really the sweet spot when we look at long-term biofuels blending with the gasoline products. Minnesota continues to be a leader in the biofuels industry. We feel we need these kinds of incentives in order to keep us there. 12,000 jobs these days, $5 billion annually to the economy. Keeping our money at home rather than sending it out state to import petroleum, we think the blender pumps will help expand the biofuels use here right in Minnesota. In addition to that economic benefit, there is also a significant environmental benefit because the greenhouse gas emissions are at least about 60% below that of gasoline. So we strongly support the request that Representative Anderson has here before you and appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I didn't get your name.
Ron Harnack.
Harick?
Harnack.
Harnack. Thank you. Question about the 30% ratio and what's the difference in the BTU ratings for that as opposed to pure gasoline?
Madam Chair and Representative, since my expert isn't here, but I can certainly get that information and provide that for you.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I have just a couple of questions. One is, I know it's up to 20,000 per pump. How many eventually would you anticipate is the need? How many would you hope to have throughout the state eventually?
Madam Chair, this grant program would have a $20,000 maximum, so this would provide help for 10 per year. Right now there's about 385 E85 pumps in the state, but so this would be just kind of a jump start, wouldn't fully meet the demand for the pumps that I think we should have out there. It would just be a kind of a jump start and encouragement.
All right, and then my other question, thank you, Madam Chair, is just how adaptable, Mr. Harnack talked about, you know, the fluctuation that it could go from E10 to E30 eventually or whatever. How adaptable are the blender pumps that would be put in at this point?
Madam Chair and Representative, the ones that are in place right now out there should not have any particular difficulty once the multiple blend pumps are in place. We have had some issues currently regarding whether or not the tanks can accommodate the increasing blends, but we're working those out with PCA and our discussions there, and hopefully the ongoing discussions of the biofuels working group will look at other opportunities to continue to incent the use of biofuels in Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I do have one more question. It goes back to, because it is only 10 per year, and you're really looking at a larger number, I'm just wondering how you might determine that the people coming forward would receive the grants. Is it first come, first served, or is it, will you do it by location? Do you have an idea how you'd want it to be distributed?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. In the past, these programs have been administered by the Department of Ag and Minnesota Clean Air Association, and I have one more testifier who could address that question.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is John Hunter. I am with the American Lung Association in Minnesota. We've worked on vehicle issues for the past 15 years or so because tailpipes are the largest source of air pollution in Minnesota. This started with a Department of Energy project in 15 years ago with E85 and building out the infrastructure in Minnesota. Our work has also included managing funds previously appropriated by the legislature to the Department of Commerce from 2007 to 2011, as well as a number of other infrastructure development programs. In the interest of time, I'll skip most of what I was going to say and just mention that, as said, we have about 365 sites that sell E85 in Minnesota. 77 of those have blender pumps currently. They've been much more the current trend of putting them in versus the initial infrastructure was just a single product, the E85 product. And as mentioned, this would be the infrastructure we'd want to help develop the market for the renewable fuels standard on the national level and E15. But I'm sorry, Representative Poppe, if you'd remind me of the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. I was just wondering about how it would be distributed, the dollars, because it's not enough to serve everybody. So is it going to be by location? Do you have certain areas in the state that you're going to try to target where you get the blender pumps, or is it first come, first served?
The previous programs that we've, Madam Chair, Representative Poppe, the previous programs we've worked with have been a first-come, first-served basis. We certainly like to see that the infrastructure develop as close to the larger population centers. And so I think much of the marketing efforts, that kind of stuff, the outreach to service stations have been somewhat metro-focused, but development has occurred throughout a large portion of the state. And if members are interested, I do have maps of the current infrastructure with me if people would like to see that.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Representative Anderson. House File 349 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Poppe, would you, your witnesses are here, and let us, why don't you bring up House File 595. And if you want to just bring up all your witnesses together.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
If you want to bring up all your witnesses.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. House File 595 is being passed out by the pages right now. And if we can get an extra chair up there. Is there an extra chair? Mm-hmm. You just pull that chip right there. Super. Okay. Well,
thank you.
All right. Okay. Representative Poppe, if you would like to begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bill that is related to honeybee habitat and pollinator habitat. And this bill I'm authoring, but Representative Torkelson is the second author and kind of the impetus behind the bill. He had a constituent who brought the issue forward, and I know we've heard about it in ag policy as well. We've had Representative McNamer talked about the honeybees and their demise over the number of years, and so we're trying to find a way to be able to encourage the honeybees and help with their habitat, and it was also related to getting the DNR perhaps to help us to locate some of the honeybee hives on property that maybe wouldn't originally have been thought of. So I do have testifiers with me, and I'll just let them introduce themselves and then be able to speak to what the crux of the bill is. Thank you.
Representative Poppe, would you like to move this for possible inclusion in the
Absolutely.
Omnibus bill?
Absolutely. I would like to move House File 595 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and everybody. Thank you so much for bringing this bill up. This is super important. Honeybees are the most important pollinators of our food. About a third, loosely about a third of our food is dependent on honeybee on pollination, and our wild bees, our native bees, also contribute very much, an untold amount, toward pollination of our food crops. Minnesota is one of the highest honey-producing states in the nation, traditionally, although honey yields have been down considerably, and a lot of that is due to many problems, and one of them is the lack of habitat for bees, flowers. So bees feed on pollen and nectar from flowers, and there's simply not enough flowers out there to support good nutrition of our honeybees and the honey production in this state. So the plantings of flowers, habitat for bees in conservation easements, would be a great benefit to the whole beekeeping industry here in Minnesota. So there's three beekeepers here. I'll just answer questions if they come up.
Thank you, Dr. Spivak. If you all,
oh, I should have introduced myself. I'm sorry.
That's okay. If you, the rest of you, would introduce yourself to the record and just say a few words if you would like, or you want just to answer questions. It's up to you.
Madam Chair, I'm Conrad Leggett from the St. Cloud area. I live about 14 miles northwest. I've kept bees for approximately 35 years as a hobby, and I've seen a great change in what's happening in the rural area. I mean, we're losing our fence lines, we're losing CRP. The farming community has changed drastically. Where I am, there used to be a lot of dairy. There's not much dairy, very little hay planted. How do farmers take care of their crops? They're looking for four or five cuttings of hay versus three. They've become very good managers. They cut their hay earlier than they used to. So we're not getting the bloom that we used to get to be able to get the pollen and the honey production to keep our bees very healthy and alive. I will close with that, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, my name is Tim Rambo, and I operate about 1,000 colonies in the Brown County, centered in Brown County, Minnesota, and Morgan. I guess I'd like to reinforce what the gentleman just said. Beekeeping has changed dramatically. I've got 31 years of experience. I began when I was 17. I'm seeing the same things that he described. It takes almost 100,000 pounds of high fructose corn syrup to support my operation from the month of approximately April to the 1st of November, and that amount has increased dramatically in recent years, and I think it's going to continue to increase. Beekeepers are faced with many challenges that most or a lot of folks are familiar with: viruses, parasitic mites, and lack of forage is one of them. So if we could somehow move in a different direction or change some things to improve the environment for the bees, that would benefit us tremendously. Thank you.
My name is Chuck Hendricks. I and my wife have had a full-time commercial beekeeping business for over 26 years now, and it's our sole source of income. We've done this for, like say, 26 years, and over that period of time, we've seen the same thing. We're in southern Minnesota here in Nicollet and Le Sueur counties. Most of our bees are located, and we've seen the same thing with loss of habitat due to changes in agriculture. Most dairy operations now, I'd say 98% of dairy operations don't even pasture cattle anymore. They're confinement buildings. They buy hay from the Dakotas. They don't even raise their own hay. So those numbers of acres of pasture and hay lands have decreased dramatically over this 26-year period that I've been in the business. And it's just mostly due to farming practices changing. So anything that we can do to reestablish some of that habitat to start to offset some of those losses because of the changes in agriculture would be a great benefit to our industry and the health of the beekeeping and the environment in general. And I would like to see it even go beyond. I know we're talking about state-owned lands, but I would like to see this expand to include state and county roadsides. These state lands are isolated areas that could help out a lot of the bees, but the roadsides would affect every buddies' locations. They're everywhere, and with the intense row cropping and less of these other areas, even those roadsides, if they could be seeded as well into some of the legumes instead of just straight grasses. So always when you rebuild roads is to put a mix of those plants in those roadsides. And to, I know the DNR encourages no roadside mowing until August 1st, for mostly for the bird nesting, ground nesting birds, but also for foraging for the bees, because most of those plants that we depend on for honey go to seed by August, and so that main bloom period is late June and through July are the critical times. But nobody waits until August 1st to mow their roadsides too, so we lose all that habitat too then with this roadside mowings. So even to incorporate that into this thinking would really go a long way in helping to offset some of the losses that we've had in bee foraging habitat. Thank you.
Representative Kahn has a question. And then I'd ask Mr. Jasky to, if he would join us for this, a little bit of this discussion.
I know there's a move towards urban beekeeping, and I know Minneapolis has an ordinance and they're looking at a changed ordinance. Can we think of maybe doing a model ordinance for urban beekeeping? Mm-hmm. Minneapolis is now looking at one for rooftop beekeeping, which we need them to come down a story. It's good for two-story buildings, but our flat part is one story. So is there anything that can be done about encouraging more urban areas to do beekeeping? Because I think that gets us the furthest from pesticide application and so forth. So, thoughts?
Representative Kahn, I hope Minneapolis ordinance allows beekeeping right now, because
it does.
Representative Daphne's been keeping bees.
Well, but it's pretty kind of restrictive in terms of fencing, okay, and so forth, and consent of neighbors and so forth. And they're proposing another one, which for rooftop beekeeping, which gets rid of the fencing requirements and some of the consent requirements. So
that's something we can discuss.
So,
Madam Chair, would you like, Representative Kahn, I'd like to address this. I'm Marla Spivak from the University of Minnesota. I should have introduced myself.
Yeah.
There are ordinances throughout the city. Most cities and suburbs have ordinances to keep bees, and Minneapolis is in the process of changing it to establish some language about rooftop beekeeping. But urban beekeeping is a different animal than what these guys are up against. So that's mostly for backyard hobby beekeeping, which is excellent and produces a little bit of honey. But the real issue is our commercial beekeepers who are doing this for a living, and very, very difficult to make a living. So we need many more flowers. Urban environments actually have pretty many flowers for bees, but actually the pesticide issue in our cities is worse than it is in agricultural lands. So it's something to be very careful, pay attention to.
Well,
thank you.
You know, I think I've read articles about actually commercial production of honey in New York City, for example, which you think would be further from flowers than... But and I know there is one commercial production on a hotel in, kind of close to the stadium area. How is that going?
Madam Chair, yes, there are honeybee colonies on rooftops in the city. There's one on the Fauché Tower, for example, and we'll be putting a colony of honeybees on the top of Minneapolis Institute of Arts and other locations. So rooftop beekeeping is good, but it's not commercial.
Okay.
It's just producing a few pounds of honey from that one colony. These gentlemen, these commercial beekeepers, have anywhere from 2,000 to up to 10,000 colonies of bees, and that's what they do for a living, and that's when you need more flowers. Thank you, though.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jasky, could you help us out here? One of the things... that occurred to me as we were hearing this bill in an earlier committee is that you have guidelines for folks who restore prairies, and you have specific seed guidelines. And I'm wondering if within those guidelines we had taken into consideration needing flowering from spring to through the fall for our honeybees and native bees. And if not, is that something we could consider doing?
Madam Chair, John Jasky, Director of Board of Water and Soil Resources. Your question, I'm not sure. I'd have to talk to one of my staff, Dan Shaw, specifically about that. The guidelines have been developed, and they were aimed at, you know, native plant communities as being the practice that we were trying to make sure we had the highest quality and most effective methods to establish. I will ask my staff person about that, and whether it was explicit or implicit, I will let you know on that as well.
One of the earlier testimony from Dr. Sean Schottler at Science Museum of Minnesota was that while the price per pound of forbs, flowering prairie plants, was higher, the seeds were so small that the price is really no higher than grass seed. So the second thing he testified to was that given a choice, pheasants and birds prefer the prairie with a lot of forbs in it. So perhaps we can, I was going to say kill two birds with one stone, but that would be an inappropriate thing to say here. Perhaps we can get two things done for the price of one if we look at this the way you are proposing seeds. So that's something that we can discuss as part of helping out here. I mean, it's not what the bill asked for, but I think there's some other things that we can do earlier.
Yeah, Madam Chair, as you know, our projects and practices are on private lands, and so the standards would apply to all of those projects, and we do many of them, some of them anyway, in concert with the USDA, who has a specific initiative about pollinator habitats, so I'm sure we could line something up with them, too.
Well, we will be asking the same question of DNR about the range of forbs on their lands, because I think that's where we're multiplying it. The second issue, and thanks for that looking, and we will get back to folks and let them know what's going on when we get a report from Mr. Jasky, and we'll ask the same question of DNR and get back to you on that. But there was one other thing I was thinking that we should be talking about, and that is Dr. Gladowich at the University of Minnesota is doing a lot of work about teaching people how to restore and what the best practices are. And again, I wonder if that this looking out for the bees, both the natives and the non-natives, is part of that curriculum. And if it is not, I think that maybe we should be talking about that. That would be a third thing we could do that is not in this bill, but some things that would be practical to do at this we could get going on, I guess is the way I wanted to say it. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and some of us take the two birds with one stone literally, so we like, and Madam Chair, along those lines, flowers are really important for young wild birds, so the more flowers absolutely in the prairie is a very good thing. Representative Poppe, I just have a question on line 1.14 of your bill. It says the commissioner shall exclude native prairie and lands within SNAs from exclusion. I'm wondering if we could change that, if you'd be interested in changing that shall to a may. I think there's sometimes, as the chair herself has alluded to, the native prairie can be very good for the bees, and I'm thinking some management, but yet without the introduction of non-natives, it may be possible. And I'm wondering if a may is a possibility there.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative McNamara, and I would think that that would be acceptable to do. I'm not sure if everybody even I didn't have this bill in my packet, so I just want to make sure if everybody had it. And it is the first engrossment, I believe.
Right. It's not the one that's it isn't the right one.
I think we amended it in ag policy, Madam Chair, and I'm not sure that this is the updated bill.
It is not the updated bill.
Thank you. Okay.
So I think it is okay in the bill that came from ag policy, and we will use that one rather than this one.
Madam Chair, are you saying that the bill may already say may instead of shall?
I believe so.
Yes, I believe it does. That's part of what we were correcting in the bill. So, but I apologize that this isn't the updated one.
The other thing I think we can talk to about, Representative Hansen isn't here, but he's on the Lessard Sams, and a lot of the lands that are being purchased now are grasslands, which I think tend to be brome. And if we were to do more restoration of those lands rather than just keeping them in brome, we might be furthering what you need. So I think I think of four things that we should be pursuing that are not necessarily in this bill, but things that we should be pursuing in addition.
Thank you. I'm sorry, my hearing is not the best. I'm having a hard time hearing you, Madam Chair. So if you're asking me a question, I'm not asking you a question.
I'm just suggesting that there's some other things that we should be pursuing as a committee in addition to what you're proposing. And I'm not sure that any of them take statutory changes, but we will look and see if they do.
Sure.
But I do think these are things that we should be working on. So I think this has not been part of what we've been thinking about as we've been doing Habitat. So this is a good, I appreciate you bringing this bill. Mm-hmm. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. You know, the impetus behind this bill is to dramatically increase the availability of food for our bee population here in Minnesota, both native and non-native. And we need not to pick around the edges. We need to really try and get lots of flowers on the ground.
It couldn't make me happier, Representative Torkelson. I think we have to find some partners that will help us do that, but that there's nothing that would make me happier. Mm-hmm. Okay. The reason we don't have the second engrossment, it's not available yet. It just hasn't been transferred, but it will come to this committee, and we will lay it over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for coming to testify. We all appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Fisher, if you would come up, we have four bills from you, and let's just start and go through them. And you might want to bring up your testifiers right away.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm going to move all the House files right away. House file 684, House file 1329, House file 1372, and House file 1373. Okay. Before we get started on this, because we're switching subjects now, members, if you'll note in your packet, there are some printouts from the Pioneer Press. They have done three articles on groundwater issues. I suspect there was another one in the paper today that I haven't seen. And they're excellent articles and really help define some of the issues that we have been discussing. So just good information for members. Representative Fisher, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, appreciate the opportunity to come before you today with these number of bills that we have to address areas that's not only within the local area but has impacts across the entire state. I believe White Bear Lake, that the issues that we're seeing up there is something that's tied in that to a bigger problem that we're going to see with water availability and water quality throughout the entire state of Minnesota. Several of the bills kind of build on each other. I do want to mention that Bill 684 actually builds on Bill 1329. We are looking at, it's a collaboration type effort where we're working together with communities across the area. This is not just local to White Bear Lake, but it is also hitting the communities in the entire Northeast metro area. This is something that has a number of groups that I've brought, that we have brought together. We've got people from the business community here today. We've got people from governmental agencies. And we have several groups that have been working very closely on it. One of the first groups I'm going to be having talk to us today is from the White Bear Lake Restoration Association. I have Dr. Ellen from Roberts, Kaplan, Miller, and Cerisi to start off with a little bit of information and a handout. And then I have a couple more testifiers after there. Dr. Allen, if you'd like to.
Madam Chairman, I'm Dick Allen. I'm a lawyer here in the Twin Cities. We're involved in a suit that comes out of what's going on up at White Bear Lake. as Madam Chairman, I think you're familiar with the fact that it's kind of seen right now, I think, as the canary in the coal mine, at least in the Northeast metro area, about because of the groundwater going down and the pressure on the aquifer up there, as documented by the USGS study. And we are working with other organizations. I represent with others the White Bear Lake Restoration Association. What the suit is about simply is to try and help prompt the DNR to move towards managing the groundwater in the Northeast metro area consistent with the broader needs of all the communities, instead of treating each well appropriation, be it commercial or municipal, as a standalone request. We're hoping as the matter goes on that the suit turns out to be an effort to prompt and support the efforts to move towards a balanced restoration of the lake levels from restoring the groundwater. Because White Bear Lake, like several of the lakes, up at Turtle and others, rely on the underlying aquifer. And when there is such a tremendous pressure on the aquifer from commercial wells and municipal wells, unfortunately the aquifer turns around and draws more water out of the lakes. DNR, of course, you know, is the statutory protector of the natural resources, in particular the groundwater, and so that therein lies the reason that we feel like we have to bring that suit. That said, White Bear Lake's gone down over 6 feet since 2003, and it isn't just because of rain, drought, and you'll hear from other people, Barry Jones from the USGS. We wanted to just explain to you we're not litigation crazy here. What we're trying to do is help move the ball over in the area where we can have more direct impact with the DNR. There's some handouts here. If I can just run through it real quick, it's basically a summary of some of the background information. Of course, White Bear Lake is historically an important lake, not only in literature, but it's in the history of this part of the state. It's been a destination for people not only to live, but for commercially and hotels and so on. It's been written about in books and Mark Twain and F. Scott Fitzgerald. It's a unique and important natural resource. As you go through the materials, we've just summarized very quickly, Madam Chair, the basis for why it is in such a dire situation, why we think it in particular needs some specific help. Mr. McGoldrick here, who is from the area and is involved in the Restoration Association, can tell you more about the impact on commercial and the beaches and so on. But the handouts are simply give you a chance to see why we're focusing on White Bear Lake. Thanks.
My name is Brian McGoldrick. I'm with White Bear Lake Restoration Association. Madam Chair, representatives, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I own I'm permitted for 200 boat slips on White Bear Lake, a bar, restaurant, marina, and a boat launch. Unfortunately, our marina has lost close to $1.5 million the last 4 years. We're anticipating losses again this year, close to $400,000. where 6 years ago we had water depths of 7 feet, 320 feet out. Our docks are now out 600 feet, and at 320 feet we had 2.5 inches last year. The lake dropped another 18 inches over the summer, even though our precipitation in the Twin Cities area was 0.3 inches below normal. And it's not just the, you know, my marina, it's also the other two marinas in the bay that are struggling with not having access. And it's important to note that our customer base is not the big mega yachts that you might see on Lake Minnetonka or on the St. Croix River. It's predominantly pontoon boats, small sailing craft, small fishing boats. And in essence, with the lake being down, the boat launches are darn near unusable. There's three of them on the lake. Ours is closed. The one at Ramsey County Beach is very, very difficult, and we're really starting to limit the access, or the access to the limit is very limited to the public. Boat traffic is down about 70% because you just can't drop your boat in there. And in addition to that, on both sides of Commercial Bay, where you have Veterans Park and Lions Park, where we have public fishing, the DNR did a shoreline restoration project back when we had the governor's fishing opener. It's completely overgrown with cattails. There's not access at all for any person to come and do some fishing. In addition to that, we've seen property values drop close to 60%, and it's not just on the lake. It's in the ring around the lake. It's no longer a desirable lake. Manitou Island is now Manitou Peninsula. And in addition to that, the shortest distance between two points on White Bear Lake, I should say the fastest as far as the sailors go, there's floating islands of milfoil. So you'll send out a scout team to see where the milfoil is and sail around them. You know, the whole ecosystem in the lake is flipping. And we're in a very, very dire situation. We need some immediate action. And I hope that the committee sees the situation that we're in and makes best efforts to help us out. I just want to thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Representative McNamara, did you have a question?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just curious. I think it's rather unique, and I've been, in my legislative years, I've always distanced myself from lawsuits. I think that I'm actually really troubled that the first testifier was Mr. Allen, who's actually suing us. And I'm trying, Representative Fisher, to understand what was that message about. I don't understand that. We've got this issue of the lake and the level of it going down, but we're in the middle of a lawsuit, and we bring one party in here to testify in the legislature. I really think, Madam Chair, it was inappropriate, and I'm trying to understand. I don't want to weigh in on that lawsuit. I want to respect the people's right to sue, but I don't know that it's right, and I don't know that I want to hear from the DNR in the lawsuit. I want to respect that and keep that separate, and I'm trying to understand what that was about.
Well, if this is the legislature and with the separation of powers, it was the administration, not the legislature, that was sued. Representative Fisher?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative McNamara. What we're trying to do is we're working with a number of groups across the area. We want to make sure that everyone who had an interest in it had an opportunity to speak today. I've got other people who are going to be testifying from the Chamber of Commerce. We also have a community group that has come together, a conservation group that also has a number of solutions. They have one of the representatives that are going to be here. I've got people from the local mayor is also here. So what we're trying to do is not exclude anybody in the process. We're trying to be an inclusive part of the process. I did not mean to set a negative tone by having the first testifiers being those that were involved in the lawsuit, but what we're trying to do is give everyone their opportunity to be heard by the legislature. So it's being done from that point of view.
Thank you. Representative Kahn.
Well, I just wanted to say an attempt to end the lawsuit, in a sense, to bring the parties together, is since the legislature specifically isn't involved in it, is, I think, the most useful thing we could be doing. Plus, as Representative Fisher says, this is not White Bear Lake. The problem of the removal of groundwater and looking at DNR's own evidence that they've given us about how little they seem to know about it and how little they seem to control this, seems to me that it's a perfect thing for us to be talking to the talking about. And as you know, we certainly don't prohibit DNR from saying anything they want before this committee or any other committee in the legislature. So I think it's a good idea.
Thank you. Representative Fisher, if you would like to continue with your next witness.
Thank you, Chair. The next person I have is Bill Fusard, who's with the White Bear Chamber of Commerce.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much. My name is Bill Fusard. I own and operate Best Western White Bear Country Inn and Rudy's Red Eye Grill in White Bear Lake. I'm one of 300 members of the White Bear Lake Area Chamber of Commerce, and we support the HF Bill 684 and HF 132029. You know, we're a small business operator in White Bear Lake. With the lake down 6 feet, it's incredible. In the past, we have all these people that come enjoy our asset, the lake, day boaters and whatever. After they come off boating, they come in and use our town. If it's getting gas, if it's coming in the restaurants, if it's stopping for a beer or whatever, we just, business is really affected. And the lake is our asset for the area. And I just hope we can work together and really find out how to resolve the declining lake level and replenish it and really bring the asset back to what it needs to be. I appreciate all your time and interest in our town, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. The next person I'd like to introduce is Dr. Ali Hassan. He's been involved from the Met Council, and he's also been serving on the task force that's been looking at solutions up in the area.
Thank you, Dr. Welcome to
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee. My name is Ali El Hassan. I'm the manager of water supply planning in the Metropolitan Council. I'm going to address the first part of this presentation, which is mainly about water supply in the metro area. This is a three-part presentation. The first one is water supply, the second one, impact and resources, and the third part is local partnership. Madam Chair, members, you have seen this presentation about a month ago when I came in front of the committee again to present talking about the water supply trends in the metropolitan area. As we have seen this since the 70s, more reliance on groundwater is being persistent in the metro area. As of now, about 70% of the population in the metro area rely on groundwater as their main source of water supply. Only 30% receive and use surface water. By 2030, the metropolitan area population is projected to increase by 500,000 people. This is extra. Additional 500,000 people are projected to move to the metro area. 12% of that is expected to be in the Northeast Metro. To meet the additional demand, the average daily water use will increase by 134 million gallons a day in the metro area, entire metro area. 6 million gallons per day are for the Northeast Metro. To meet this demand, the available water supply mostly is coming from groundwater. Out of that 134 million gallons a day, 117 is expected to come out of groundwater. And this is what's planned as of now for 2030 by different communities in the metro area. Looking at the impact of this increase or additional pumping of 117 million gallons a day in the metro area from our aquifers, it will result in an additional decline in our water levels around the metro area. The blue indicates, the color blue in this map indicates decline in water levels. The darker the shade of the blue, the greater the impact or the greater the decline in our water levels. If we continue business as usual, meaning relying on groundwater as the main source of water supplies, the aquifer will continue to decline as by 2030 we'll start seeing such impacts. Unfortunately, in many places around the metro area, we started seeing those impacts right now. It's not 2030, it's right now for many places. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think we would need to follow up with some questions here. You've laid out the problem. What are the solutions that you would recommend to us?
We started working in the metropolitan area to address some of those solutions, looking into future direction for the metro area. And one of the solutions that we are studying right now is the rebalancing the water use in the metro area, meaning instead of relying 100% or 90% on groundwater, to increase our use of surface water, especially knowing that we have plenty of surface water available in the metro area. As example, we are using only 2% of the Mississippi River flow for the two big municipalities using surface water in the metro area, St. Paul and Minneapolis. Looking at the flow in the river, on average, we have about 2.7 trillion gallons a year flowing in the Mississippi River alone. Not talking about the Minnesota River, not talking about the St. Croix. As of now, the two main cities that use surface water, the two main surface water systems in the metro area, they have excess capacity of about 75 million gallons a day. This is beyond their availability, their water use.
Hang on to that number for just a moment. So could you break that down between the two cities?
Minneapolis, I understand they have about 50 million gallons a day of excess capacity. St. Paul have 25 million gallons of excess capacity.
Okay. And that is not a number that we are used to dealing with when it comes to water. So say for St. Paul at 25 million gallons a day, if that were to be used by another municipality, what would be the size of the municipality that that would support?
As of now, we understand, and this is just the very preliminary studies that we have done, it looks like the communities of Hugo, White Bear Lake, Matomidai, and Township, White Bear Township, they all can be connected to St. Paul with this amount of water.
So would these communities be communities all within the White Bear Lake watershed, or are some of these communities beyond the White Bear Lake watershed?
Those are some of the communities, like Hugo is beyond the watershed, but it's part of the Northeast Metro Aquifer. They are still one of the big communities that you're utilizing a lot of groundwater from the aquifer.
I see. Okay. So while we have some excess in the St. Paul system, not certainly enough for other communities that are running into water problems, and I would suggest Woodbury would be one of those where water is limited. So the St. Paul system could absorb a piece of the puzzle, but clearly not the, am I getting this right? But
that's correct.
Not the entire.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Has the Metropolitan Council looked at the possibility of another water treatment system further down the river? I mean, there's Minneapolis, there's St. Paul. Has that possibility been raised?
That's one of the issues we are looking at right now. This is part of a preliminary study that we are putting together right now.
And can you tell us just a little bit about that?
We are looking into different potential locations for utilization of more surface water in addition to the existing two systems. At this point, it's at the very early stages of that, and truly, we don't have a lot of information about that yet. We're still looking into that, and we're starting to put together our proposals for that.
I think it's excellent that you're doing this, because it hasn't been done before, and it's been long overdue. Help me understand how long it's going to take for that part of the process to be done, so we have this a better big picture and of what we may need in another water treatment system.
Probably such a feasibility study, it will take at least 1 year from now if we get funding for it, or if we continue doing this work. If we start now, it's going to take us a year at least to come up with some results that can be presented to the committee or somewhere else. But I think it's at least 1 year from now.
So has the Metropolitan Council allocated money for this study or yet?
This is going to be part of our Clean Water Fund request looking into the future.
So that's part of the request that's on the table right now?
That's correct.
Oh, good. Okay. Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Ellison, would that be how you, is that close? Correct. Thank you, Doctor. Doctor, what is the white line that went through my area that it kind of got wider through, it goes just through Nininger Township and down through Marchand and stuff. What is that white line?
Some of those locations are indicating, I think, rift or geological formation in that area that we don't have some information at this point on those areas.
Okay. Thank you. And Madam Chair and Dr. Ellison, so the areas that we have the biggest problems are developed urban areas, not the rural areas of our metropolitan area.
That's correct.
And what effect, thank you, Madam Chair, and what effect, we put in some legislation that allows communities to charge more for the people that are using more water. Do you think that that would do better if we did even more of that, and should communities be considering that, communities like White Bear, if they went to, I think Woodbury has one of the more aggressive, where they have seen some reduction in water use by tiering, and maybe would that prepare communities, because the water rates are much higher in St. Paul and Minneapolis than they are in some of the outlying areas, would the tier rates prepare people for that, and would that cut down on the water use?
Madam Chair, committee members, we think in the Metropolitan Council the problem in White Bear Lake is beyond conservation only. Conservation can play a big role in helping, elevating some of the problems, but we think now it's beyond the solution should look into a package instead of one way of dealing with the problem. Conservation, even though it's a very good thing to do, it's very healthy for the aquifers, still is not going to solve the problem that we're starting seeing, especially knowing that we have many of the people are projected to move into the metropolitan area. So increased demand is one of the biggest problems we have to deal with.
But thank you, Madam Chair. But Dr. Ellison, the conservation rate, water rates would prepare people for what I think is going to be the wave of the future. We have really taken water, I don't want to say totally for granted, but our inexpensive water has certainly been something that we take for granted. And I think the conservation rates would begin to prepare people. And we do see, there was the example in the paper this morning, the Santa Fe. They really do work and prepare people. They don't take water for, I think, if I'm not mistaken, in Santa Fe, I'm trying to remember, did they say the water rate was $100 a month? And comparable in our cities is $9 a month. I think that would prepare people for what really is the future, and I'm hopeful that more communities would do that.
Madam Chair, if I can address that. I used to work in Santa Fe as a part of the state engineer in New Mexico 10 years ago. And one of the very aggressive conservation programs in the country is in Santa Fe. But by 2007, they found out that the impact of the conservation is not good enough, so they contracted to get water, surface water from Rio Chama River to replace some of their pumping. But they started that by conservation.
Thank you. Representative Fisher.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara. The other thing I'd like to mention is that in terms of conservation pricing is there is another bill that I have going that is in front of the Policy Committee of the Environmental Natural Resource. And one of the things that we've been looking at is changing things a little bit, because besides the water conservation pricing, which is very important to address that part because water is so cheap, is that there's a lot of areas right now that the DNR has no control over at all. There's a lot of very small wells out in that area, private wells and smaller wells that use quite a bit out of the aquifer. We don't do any permitting or anything or licensing along those lines. And that adds quite a bit to this whole equation, and that's something else that we're looking at incorporating that as a part of a solution, and that's just one of the multi-prongs. As you're kind of hitting on, what you're hearing from here is just one part, and there's a number of other areas that the things that we're going to have to look at as going forward. So I'm glad to hear you're interested in that, and I'll look for more of that discussion when we get to that in the next committee.
Representative Bork.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I very much appreciate what you're doing, and I also appreciate Representative McNamara's comments and encouragement to have a financial incentive for people to pay attention. I'm wondering what other perhaps educational programs. So people turn on the tap and use water and are oblivious to the quantities of water that they use. And I'm wondering if there are some ways or things that are in place or you're thinking about programs to increase the awareness beyond just hitting people in the pocket.
Madam Chair, members, in the Metropolitan Council in 2008, we developed what we call Conservation Toolbox. It's a website tool that House members or if you for household tips for conservation, as well as for municipalities tips for conservation. It helps people understand if they do so and so in the house, that will result in this reduction in their water use, and it will result in this amount of money that they will save by doing that. So it's a tool that guides households as well as municipalities into saving water step by step. I think DNR also, they have some tools that's available on their website. One of the things that Metropolitan Council, with the help of DNR, Department of Natural Resources, and USGS is planning right now, we are putting together a series of seminars or workshops in the White Bear Lake area. We're starting with White Bear Lake area. And this series is going to address a couple of issues, groundwater 101. It's going to address some of the problems that we have seen in White Bear Lake. It will address some of the options that's out there for solution for this problem. And one seminar is going to be about conservation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that response. The other part of my thinking on this is the Woodbury has been mentioned, and that's one of my communities. And the I understand half of their water use is commercial, particularly associated with gravel pit. And I'm wondering if you have recommendations about how communities and businesses could also pay more attention to the water that they're using and how they can not only perhaps temper the amount of water, but to restore the water that they have used and make it clean again.
Madam Chair, members, part of our master water supply plan for all the metropolitan communities, we develop what we call the water supply profile for each community. This is 186 communities in the metro area. And for each community, we address some of the issues that they are dealing with them right now and the future issues that might raise there. And I think one of them is water quality and water quantity for Woodbury. I would be very happy to provide that information to you.
Thank you. I truly appreciate the work you're doing for us. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for Representative Fisher. I see that you're intending to take this money from the Clean Water Fund. Have you presented this idea to the Clean Water Council?
No, I have not, and it was just a recommendation. If there are other funds that we can, or other areas that we could tap besides the clean water, we're very open to it. It was just a starting point, knowing that this is an area that's dealing with water and trying to preserve, protect water sources going forward. We felt that this might be a good fit, but no, I had, being rather new to the process here, I had not had a chance to meet with them yet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Fisher, have you approached LCCMR with these ideas?
No, I have not, sir.
Thank you.
You have some other testifiers, Representative Fisher?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. At this point in time, I'd like to introduce Perry Jones from the USGS.
Yeah. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Name for the record, please.
Yeah, my name is Perry Jones. I'm a hydrologist
working for the U.S. Geological Survey, the Minnesota Water Science Center. And I'd like to present some of the impacts we've seen in some of the water resources in the Northeast Metro. You know, we've talked a lot about White Bear Lake, but there's other lakes in the Northeast Metro that are having water level issues. This map shows some of the lakes and some of the issues we've seen since about 2003. Water levels have dropped in several lakes in Northeast Metro. This plot shows water levels for White Bear has dropped 6 feet. Birch Lake has gone down and also come up. Turtle Lake has also had water level issues, as well as some other less noted lakes. South School Section Lake has dropped more than 9 feet since 2003. And a lot of these lakes are lakes that are in what are called closed basin lakes. In other words, there's not a stream or a river that flows into them. They rely a lot on rainfall and groundwater inflow. But there's a lot of lakes also in the Northeast Metro that haven't had as much a water level drop. And those are lakes that are more open. They typically have a stream or a river that's providing them with water. They have much larger watersheds to keep the lake levels up. But one thing to note is when we want to figure out what's going on with the lake and why is the water level changing or it's not changing, we have to look at the whole water balance. What are the sources and what's taking water out of lakes? And if we look at the typical closed basin lakes, like the ones that we're having problems with, we rely a lot on rainfall, but we also rely a lot on groundwater inflow. Groundwater can come from local aquifers and enter into a lake, but lake water can also leave a lake and go into the aquifer system. And knowing that balance and how that balance may change over time will give us ideas of why we're seeing the changes in the lake levels. And one example that we've just completed a study looking at White Bear Lake and seeing what the impacts are of some of our use of water on lake levels is the connection we established between a local aquifer and White Bear Lake. The Prairie du Chien Jordan Aquifer, which is heavily pumped in the Northeast Metro area, we actually sampled some wells that were near White Bear Lake. And through looking at the water chemistry and comparing it from the lake as what we were seeing in the well water chemistry, we could determine that there is surface water that's leaving the lake and actually entering into the local aquifers. And then when it's in the aquifer, it then travels down and gets extracted by wells downgradient from the lake. And so it shows that there's a direct connection between the groundwater as well as our surface water sources. And so what we do to the groundwater system, if we're extracting more water out, then can have a profound effect on the surface water sources.
Very good. Thank you. And then the last person I'd like to introduce is the mayor of White Bear Lake, Joe Emerson.
Welcome to the committee. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. In 2011,
if you'd put your name on the record.
Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Joe Emerson, E-M-E-R-S-O-N.
Thank you.
In 2011, led by former Representative McFarland and Bill Broussard, a group of leaders from communities around the White Bear Lake area, along with state, local, county, and federal agencies, met to learn about the study by the USGS. Subsequently, numerous entities entered into this to fund this study through the White Bear Lake Conservation District. We all have concerns about the water, and at this point I'd like to address Representative McNamara. The city of White Bear Lake has had water conservation pricing for at least 6 years. We have reduced our consumption by 20% and are still attempting to do more. I have asked our Environmental Advisory Commission in the city to come up with ways. We have to get people to buy into conservation, and I've asked them to come up with ways that they can do this. We hope to roll it out in our spring newsletter and put it on our website. Subsequently, we will be having this meeting in White Bear Lake, I think on April 4th, called Groundwater 101, which, you know, a lot of people just need to be educated about it. I'm still learning. So I think that the local partnerships are there, and we're trying very hard to work towards a sustainable solution to this. The reason we need the legislation is economic development and quality of life issues in this area are going to be adversely impacted if we do not find a way to solve this problem. It's quick, simple, and easy to say. That's basically it. In closing, let me say we're all aware of the drought throughout the state. It isn't just in our area. But something else is happening, and we need to better understand the interaction between groundwater and surface water. It's an important issue to us, obviously, but it is to the entire state because this is happening elsewhere. And we can't afford to pass up this opportunity to learn more about the problem and hopefully to find solutions. We must protect and preserve our natural resources and our drinking water. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. I don't see any other questions. We have four bills. Are there any members of the audience who want to testify for or against or about these bills? I don't see anyone. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Representative Falk, you are the next one up. It will be distributed. Oh, yes. I will renew the motion to lay over House File 684, House File 1329, House File 1372, and House File 1373 for possible inclusion in our water bill. Representative Falk, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Which one would you like to take up first, House File 1188 or 1189?
Why don't you start with 188, and I believe the pages are and staff are distributing these right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd move that House File 1188 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
And members, this is a bill that would provide resources for a Congress in Greater Minnesota to go and help get the information out. One of the things I've learned in my time in the legislature is we are very good, and we have very good people creating information, putting together reports, but oftentimes the ability to get that information out to the places where it needs to be distributed and disseminated is not as good as it could be. And so House File 1188 is a means to do that, to go and help distribute some of the information we've gleaned from these studies and to go and make sure that folks working on groundwater management issues in Greater Minnesota are well advised of the most current and updated science. And if one of the pages would be so kind as to give me a copy as well here, I could have it so I could answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions on this, members? Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Falk, I see that you're pointing to the Clean Water Fund as a source of funding for this groundwater management conference. Is it your opinion that when the citizens of Minnesota voted for the Clean Water Legacy Amendment that they had groundwater management conferences in mind?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, one of the things I think the citizens of Minnesota voted for was acknowledgement that we have to address water issues, and part of that how we address that is through the legislative process. And so we come down here with, you know, the authority that our constituents have given us to try to find solutions. And this is one solution that I've brought forward. I know that, you know, we want to make sure that we take care of rural parts of the state, that we get the information out there, that it's not exclusively metro-centric. And it would be my hope that maybe the council would have considered doing this, but seeing that this had not been done yet, I brought forward the concept.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Falk, have you approached Clean Water Council with this idea?
Representative Torkelson, Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I have not. Part of what we have as authorities legislators is we have the ability to bring ideas before our respective bodies, and I do believe that there is a certain separation of powers issue there, and that this is the appropriate forum for me as a legislator to bring forward this idea.
Representative Torkel.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Faulk, where in the Clean Water Council's recommendations would you be taking this money from?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, right now this is an open appropriation, and if I remember correctly, the Clean Water Council's opinion or recommendations are advisory to the legislature. We ultimately make the decisions.
Representative Faulk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Faulk, how would you identify the outcomes of this effort?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, the outcome would be the fact that we're having people in greater Minnesota attending these conferences and getting access to the information that is otherwise not getting out to the folks that need to have access to it to really implement the most recent and current and updated science. Typically, I think the perception is that a lot of this information is easy to access if you live in the metro area. It's much more difficult to get access to, or at least to have it presented to you if you live in greater Minnesota. I haven't seen a number of, or particularly any instances, where we talk about these programs getting out and being presented in the far corners of the state. I don't know if Representative Fabian has had anybody come up and present to his local folks about groundwater management issues, but I'm assuming, you know, this is an assumption, that they would, if they want to have the information presented to them and be brought up to speed on the most current and updated science, that they would appreciate it being presented in their community at some points in time versus having it all presented down here.
Representative.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Faulk, is it then your intention to have one of these conferences in every legislative district in the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I did not say that. I just said this is certainly the conversation about how we get more of this in greater Minnesota versus it being metro-centric. My personal goal here is to go and get more of this information into greater parts of the state. If the Clean Water Council's intention is to keep it more metro-centric, that's their prerogative. It's not mine.
One of the things that we could possibly put on the table here is thinking about the areas in the state that do the, not the farming of products, but the production of food. And often these production areas use a lot of water, and we have identified a number of counties in, this is recent work by House Research, Colby Sullivan has identified counties that have a lot of food processing, and some of those counties, it turns out, are approaching serious water problems. Worthington, obviously, is one, but then you look at Marshall, Fairmont, up in the Otter Tail, Todd County. There's some questions about Freeborn and Maurer. These are all big food-producing counties, and we want to make, I think, crystal clear that we want these food-producing counties to have adequate water. And to do that, I think we can't just quit talking about it. I mean, just not talk about it. We do have to have conversations about water and conserving it so we have it. So I appreciate your bill, Representative Faulk. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Faulk, the conference, you say it's aimed at groundwater management professionals. Now, to me, that would indicate the DNR personnel. Who would these professionals be in outstate Minnesota?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anderson, it could be any number of county folks. It could be the, you know, we often look at Bowser's dealing exclusively with surface water, but we may have to go and expand their scope to also thinking about groundwater usages. It could be city officials that, you know, have these large processing facilities permitted within their jurisdictions. They oftentimes don't have as good of a handle on what their groundwater resources are. Simply, you know, in the macro sense, we don't have a good handle on a lot of our groundwater resources around the state. And so we need to bring a lot of groups of people together, not just DNR, to go and understand. I think one of the things that, you know, both you and I would be familiar with is potentially what would happen if, you know, CVAC ran out of water. How would you operate that facility? We don't have a handle on what the replenishment rates are in those aquifers. We don't have an idea of how much water potentially is there. And if suddenly there were just to become a day when there is no water to run the ethanol plant in Benson, I think a lot of people would be upset and wondering why we hadn't at least, you know, had the conversation to try to understand how much water there was available there.
The other group of folks that should be invited to any, and I think maybe there should be conferences or and maybe that's a word that Representative Torkelson doesn't like, and maybe we can find a better word for that, but to have maybe workshops or something. But one of the users or one of the groups of experts that needs to be at the table is all of the folks who do our drinking water for us for the small cities. They use a lot of water, have to finish it in all sorts of different ways because of different things in the water, whether it's arsenic or nitrogen or whatever. They certainly should be part of the folks who are the experts that come. Any other? Oh, Representative Fabian.
Just a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Falk, as far as the conference goes, so many of these wind up in the metro area. I would hope that maybe if that yeah. does happen, that we have it in central Minnesota, like, say, maybe Bemidji.
I'm amenable, so.
Thank you. Representative Ward, and then we'll go to the next of your bills, and we will end with that one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Falk, I'm going to express my ignorance here. Are there typically conferences or meetings, regional kinds of things that people in the rural areas get together for, or is this going to be a new experience?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Ward. We have had meetings in rural parts of the state. I don't think they happen as frequently as they often should. One of the things, I mean, just in recent, for one example, I think was maybe something that was done relatively well, was the governor called for Environmental Congress, and they held meetings around the state. We've had different meetings on a number of different subjects, but I think we all acknowledge we have a groundwater issue, and I don't think that people around the state fully understand the severity of the issue, and this is aimed at helping to bring together some of those partners and those individuals to help get people on the same page. And it's, I think, easier to go and get that buy-in or get participation when you go out around the state versus having it held exclusively down here.
Thank you. Does anybody in the audience want to testify about this bill? Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Appreciate the bill being brought forward by Representative Falk. I would just add two things. One is that just 2 weeks ago, on March 5th, was the Rural Water Association annual conference. It happens every single year. It's multiple days of training for all public water suppliers from the state of Minnesota, from rural water associations. It's all the small city water suppliers. They're there. They have mandatory training, so they attend. And it's 1,500 of them. And it happens in St. Cloud, not in the Twin Cities. And that opportunity is already there. I would really suggest that we could have a higher efficiency by piggybacking on existing training, because these folks can't just take a day off for a conference several times a year. They're running water systems in our small cities. So as this moves forward, I'd be happy to work with the chair and with the author on better ways to make this sync up with existing opportunities that we already have for reaching hundreds of our city water suppliers. And secondly, I would add that one of the challenges our cities have in getting information right now is the changing role of the regional area hydrologists for DNR. They're heavily paid now out of Clean Water Fund monies, and so they're working heavily on TMDLs and related issues with that, whereas we used to be able at the county and city levels to contact regional hydrologists for the areas to get this kind of information. They're less able to help with that now and have other job responsibilities that are taking them away from some of the technical assistance that would be very useful in finding out more information. So, Madam Chair, happy to answer any questions I can, but also happy to work on this in the future.
I think one of the things that we need to have a conversation about are not just are the technical people invited to conferences, which is good, but what about our mayors? and our city officials who make the, who do the decision making, and that is something that does seem to be lacking. So that's a part of the discussion that we need to have. Technical folks do get training, but the decision makers often are not aware of the big picture. You may see what's going on in their own area, but not the big picture. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Anybody else want to testify? All right, Representative. Oh, yes. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bob Tamman from Sudan, Minnesota. My wife and I are retired there. It's just on the north side of the Mesabi Range and the Arrowhead. And I noticed listening to testimony this morning, we rightfully heard about the groundwater problems in the metro area, agricultural area. I hope the committee won't forget that the Arrowhead mining country has similar groundwater problems. We heard about the swimming beach going dry. We could look to Gilbert, Minnesota. They had a lovely swimming beach. It's gone now. Water level went down. Beach is gone. We could look at Hibbing, Minnesota with their well. Water level went down. Well quality seriously degraded. Of course, to make a direct connection to the mining industry is not always that easy, but these things do happen in the Arrowhead. And so I would just like to express my support for Representative Faulk's legislation and hope that you won't forget the Arrowhead region of Minnesota when we're doing our groundwater research. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Faulk, would you like to finish up with House File 1189?
Sure, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 1189 be laid out for possible inclusion. And members, this is some money appropriated to the Pollution Control Agency to go and monitor baseline water quality for the new Ag Water Quality Certainty Program. I know it's one of the initiatives that we've been working on, and it's a priority for both the department and the governor. And this would be to help facilitate that program working better, because if you want to control anything, you have to be able to measure it. And part of that control is having good measurement at the onset. And so this would fund the monitoring activities.
Did he move? Okay, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Faulk, has there been any effort to coordinate the baseline monitoring in this program with the baseline monitoring that's already going on at PCN?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I imagine that would be part of the conversation we have with the Pollution Control Agency. Being this is a new program starting out, we have to have the resources appropriated to fund it. But I would imagine that would be part of what their task would be to coordinate. I mean, you wouldn't want to be doing work duplicatively that's, you know, been done. We want to make sure that it's, you know, the tests are relatively recent. I mean, we go through a number of watersheds in the state, and sometimes it seems like the data gets a little bit stale, but in many cases I do think it's relatively recent.
Madam Chair, thank you. Well, the PCA is on a 10-year cycle to monitor all the watersheds in the state. I think there'll be an opportunity here to coordinate this effort with the efforts that are already going on and not spend additional funds on monitoring, but work with the agency that is already doing this work. Good. Comment.
Representative Torkelson, the differences here is they do the 81 watersheds, and that the program that is envisioned by the Department of Agriculture would be in a sub-watershed. So it would be measuring the downstream in that sub-watershed.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for that comment. But the new RAP program, which I think you are somewhat familiar with, does involve working on sub-watersheds, and the opportunity for coordination here is certainly would be valuable to all of us.
I think we should do that.
Absolutely.
Clearly do. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Faulk, just a clarification. I think the last funding I had seen for this new voluntary program was $6 million federal money and $3 million state money. So would this be an additional appropriation to that that baseline funding?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, that is correct. And part of our job as legislators is to determine what the appropriate level of funding is.
I don't see any other questions on that. Representative Faulk moves that House File 1189 be laid over for possible inclusion in the water bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
With that, members, we will be recessing. until 4 o'clock in room 200. We're changing rooms, and we've done a good job today. We're well on our way. Thank you, members. Meeting adjourned.
And that represents cities in the 7-county metropolitan area, both here at the legislature and at the Metropolitan Council. I also have a handout here, if I could have a page pick this up.
Sure.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the...
Would you pull your microphone?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yep.
I don't think it's on.
You don't think it's on?
Madam Chair,
special favor.
My apologies. Again, my name is Patricia Naum, and I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, and I'm here to comment today about House File 581, which is requesting a $2 million appropriation from the Clean Water Fund for the purposes of assisting with inflow and infiltration mitigation efforts at the local level. This is a very significant issue for the metropolitan region. Of course, it's an issue statewide as well, but it's a very important issue for the metropolitan region. Cities in the 7-county since 2007 have been working with the Metropolitan Council. The council instituted a surcharge program back in 2007 that identified cities that were contributing excess inflow and infiltration, which is when clean water seeps into the regional wastewater system, either through broken laterals, broken pipes, or through excess rainwater, when infrastructure is not up to capacity or up to speed. I just handed out a list of, we have about 50 communities now that have been identified by the Met Council as being excess contributors of inflow and infiltration. And once cities are identified as being contributors, they are essentially tasked with making repairs to both the local public infrastructure and identifying the repairs that are needed on private infrastructure to solve this problem. If they don't, they are surcharged or fined by the Metropolitan Council. Since 2007, cities have been working to try to make repairs on the infrastructure. We have gotten bonding money for assistance with the local public infrastructure, but really the majority of this issue is located on the private infrastructure, which, you know, is the homeowner's infrastructure, essentially, whether it's, you know, sump pumps or illegal connections to the local infrastructure. This is a very significant issue, as I mentioned, for the region, because once inflow and infiltration, once this clean water gets into the regional wastewater pipes, it ends up using capacity that the pipes are not intended to be used for. So it ends up using more capacity than the pipes are able to use. And the problem is much more cost efficient to solve at the local level. Otherwise, the Met Council is going to have to build additional wastewater capacity, which would cost upwards of $1 billion. Excess INI ends up taking clean water that does not need to be treated and treats it. So we are essentially wasting that clean water. We're using up clean water, which obviously we need for other purposes. And it can also result in a potential public health threat. If you have sewage backups, if the infrastructure is compromised, you can have sanitary sewer overflows, which violates clean water standards and threatens the safety of the region's water supply. As I mentioned before, correcting INI can be done at the local level, which is much more cost efficient, and or at the regional level, which it is not. It costs a lot more money to do it that way. I want to also add that maintaining this infrastructure at the local level is very fundamental to all of us. It's infrastructure that we do not see, but we all know what happens when it's not working. Sewer infrastructure, when it's not working, quickly becomes very evident and quickly becomes a crisis. One of the things I did want to mention here is, as I mentioned, I passed out the sheet showing the 50 communities that have been identified as excess INI contributors, and we would appreciate your consideration of this request. We did make a request before the Clean Water, we did make a request to the Clean Water Council. We were not included in their funding recommendations this year. Thank you.
Just a couple of questions here. there is no provision in here for matching funds for the grants. Is that something that you are intending?
Madam Chair and members, yes. We would work with the Metropolitan Council to design a grant program. And the way that they had a very small grant program a few years ago that was meant to assist with foundation drain fixes, and that program did use a match. We could use, definitely we would look for a city match and perhaps both a city and a homeowner match to do sort of a 3-to-1 type of match to try to maximize these resources.
I think that would be a helpful addition as we work through this. You didn't talk anything about enforcement, if you would comment on that.
Yes. Madam Chair and members, as I mentioned, since 2007, the Metropolitan Council has a surcharge program that they basically will surcharge cities if cities are not working to make repairs. Each city that you see identified on that list has been working to make some repairs, a lot of it to the local infrastructure, which is more in the city's control. And so no cities have actually been fined because they're spending money to make repairs to the infrastructure rather than to be fined by the Met Council, at which point that is money that would then presumably be used down the road to fund additional capacity to the regional wastewater pipe rather than actually making the repairs. So cities do understand the importance of making these repairs to the local infrastructure, and they've been working with the Metropolitan Council to do that.
So. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, this the sheet you passed out with these 50 cities on it, I assume there's some kind of a base level that you came up with here. How did you, how was that arrived at, or how do you work that?
Madam Chair, the number, the appropriation amount, I apologize.
Madam Chair, no, the sheet you passed out with these 50 cities on it, I assume there's some kind of a base level, yes, over which they're above. How do you determine that base level?
That is determined by the Metropolitan Council. They have measurements in, you know, measuring capacity in place where they can measure the flow, basically. That, for example, if there's a peak rain event, they can tell if cities are, if they're above that rain event or if they're, in other words, an excess contributor by looking at the flows that occur or are occurring during that event and measuring them against more average flows. I don't know if that might be a technical question.
Representative Hansen.
And Madam Chair, Representative Anderson. And then to bring it down to an individual homeowner, they've had city inspections that will come in and look at their system. And the cities in West St. Paul in my district has had to respond to this, and so they're indicated as being in the need for the MAC Council. Then the city goes in and does the inspections in that part of the community where they're seeing that pressure being put on the system. And they'll go in, check out the house, check those pipes out, see if they're losing water, you know, and see if it's coming in. And then the homeowner has to either pay the full cost, or if they choose not to participate, then the enforcement, to get back to Representative Wiginius's comment, then there's the assessments that can be put on the homeowner for not making those changes.
Thank you. Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 581 be laid over for possible inclusion in the clean water or the legacy bill. Thank you, Representative Hansen. You have House File 971.
Yes, House File 971. I believe that's the drainage manual one. And I have Mr. Jashke here. 971, Madam Chair, members of the committee, you may remember the beginning of the journey we've taken on drainage over the years. Back in 2005, we had a study done about buffer strips. The drainage work group was established. And originally at that time, we had identification of needs, one of which was to have a public drainage manual, to have a manual that the viewers and those folks that are doing the material, the components of drainage needed. And we appropriated, well, the drainage work group recommended this. We started moving forward on it, and then the funding no longer appeared. And so we have been, the need is still there.
I think we've heard in this and other committees about the continuing issues related to drainage and concerns, and part of the idea with having a the drainage manual updated, and Mr. Jashka can talk about how old this is that we have applicable content that the viewers and inspectors can use to defend the decisions they make because they're trained. So, Mr. Jashke.
Madam Chair, members, this item is not identified as such in the governor's budget or the Clean Water Council, but there is an appropriation identified in both of those for conservation drainage. And so this manual, and that those dollars are largely targeted to projects and practices, you know, on these drainage systems, which, of course, most of you all know are a great part of how our water moves across the landscape in western and southern Minnesota. As Representative Hansen said, there is a manual that exists now. It's probably, I'm going to say 25 years old, because it's the same manual that was there when I began my career. It's a big three-ring binder with, you know, handwritten, you know, font. And it's been used in limited fashion, and many of the people that were there putting that together many years ago are no longer either around doing that work anymore, and that generation of folks that was instrumental in sort of starting that whole process of making the drainage systems more professionally managed is, you know, getting up there. And we think that there's a better way forward, which is to build something that more people can use. With the increased emphasis on, you know, retaining and treating water, some connection to that in the public drainage system manual would be a useful thing. I can talk more about the history or potential other uses of this, but that's my testimony.
Any questions, members? Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Jaski, how much of this money that were taken from the Clean Water Fund was Bowser going to use for on-the-ground projects? I mean, this is maybe the sixth, seventh one we've heard so far, and I see a bunch more below it. How much underground work is not going to happen, and how is your agency going to be affected by this reallocation from this fund?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, and McNamara, this is the way this is written, the way I understand that it's not taking from the funding that would have been identified in the governor's budget for conservation projects and practices. I guess if that's the case, then we'd have to talk about that. But those dollars that you're referring to that are in the governor's budget are for, you know, on-the-ground projects and practices to, you know, basically treat and store some of the water on those systems, where landowners are able to design that into their systems, or the public drainage authority can do it on their behalf.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Director. And I guess my question is for you, Madam Chair. I understand this $235,000 maybe going to be grabbed from the bottom line, but what projects are all the other ones? We've heard millions of dollars of projects coming from the fund. Where's it all going to come from?
I don't know what your question is, Representative McNamara.
Well, Madam Chair,
we have an allocation. We have advice from the Clean Water Council. We have advice from members, and we will pull it all together. And we're hearing the bills that people have submitted, and as far as I know, I'm hearing every bill that has been submitted. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious. Having done training, manuals are very important, but I have no concept of how many people would be using it. Are you talking about a physical manual or electronic? And would this be available? I think Representative Hansen mentioned, as I understand it, that the homeowner as well, to if they get involved, would they have access to understanding all of this? And would the manual then be electronic and be online?
Madam Chair and Representative Ward, the public drainage systems have a great deal of regulatory authority and responsibility behind them. And as Mr. Jashke commented, this manual is really a three-ring booklet with things that have been added to it. There is a need to move it not only from that three-ring binder model but to upgrade the content and upgrade the media so that it can be used. There aren't that many viewers, the people who go out and when there is a redetermination of benefits needed or determination of benefits to go out and assess that. Mr. Dashke, maybe 30 to 50 mm-hmm. statewide, mm-hmm. But having the need of having them trained. Now there are a whole secondary group of folks that are involved that are the inspectors. That's different than a viewer. And there are the professional staff, the soil and water districts, counties, county auditors in some cases, drainage watershed districts. So there's a variety of folks that are involved beyond this. As we've talked about some other manuals, we want to, in 2013, we want to move away from paper so that we're not having to do this every 20 years, that we would take these into other media and be able to adapt them and update them over time.
I don't see any other questions. Members, House File, Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 971 be laid over for possible consideration. Representative Hansen, I see you have House File 1277. Oh. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, I would be willing to, I know there are some members that are may have other committees, and I would be willing to let them hop in if needed. So I know there are some here.
Okay. If that is the case, Representative Keel, are you one of those people?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to submit House File 968 for a possible inclusion. In the interest of time, I'll just give you a little comment here, and then I'm going to let Mr. Fritz explain this bill or what we do here. This is an appropriation for the Red River North monitoring. It is a group. It's called the River Watch Program in the Valley. In the Red River Valley goes quite extensively. I think it's almost, you can clarify that, but I think it's almost 30 schools where we encourage students, a program that we have students work on watershed science and develops a critical thinking, leadership skills, and is quite a successful program. Unfortunately, we don't have students today because they're busy tomorrow with this event. So with that, I'll let Mr. Fritz explain what happens here.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Charles Fritz. I'm the director of the International Water Institute. My organization was formed after the 1997 flood to perform or conduct watershed research and watershed education in the Red River Basin. One of our signature programs is the River Watch program. It started as a pilot project in the Sand Hill watershed in 1995 with four schools, and today there are 30 schools today with the addition of Frazee, Minnesota this year, who are working with my staff to do a number of watershed education and watershed science activities in the Red River Basin. The students go through a rather rigorous training and certification process, so when they collect the water quality data, it can be used by the Minnesota Pollution Control and other agencies to do to make decisions. And we do a number of other outdoor education activities. And I want to thank Representative Keel for carrying this bill, but she mentioned there's no students here. Tomorrow, this is the 18th year of the Riverwatch Forum. It's an annual forum where these students get to come and kind of show and tell what they've learned over the year. And this is the first time in 18 years that I've missed it. But there will be roughly 300 students at the University of Minnesota Crookston tomorrow. And it's one of those events that's very uplifting for me because really I see these students as our next generations of leaders. And this is one of those programs that has the ability or has the is working hard to instill that sense of watershed stewardship in these students. And so I guess if any questions, I'd entertain them now.
I also would like to point out, Madam Chair, that this is funded in part by also the Red River Watershed Management Board, and also local watershed districts partner up with Clean Water Fund for this program.
Could you give us those figures later, not now, but could you just provide us with the
sure.
partnership figures later on? That would be helpful. One question. You talk about students developing critical thinking, which is great. But as students critically think, one of the things they've got to be thinking about is the relationship between groundwater and surface water. Have you begun developing curriculum that has students working to understand both as they are doing this surface water monitoring?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, most of the monitoring that our students do is surface water quality monitoring, certainly. But as a part of this exercise, for example, we have this River Explorers program, which gives them affords them an opportunity to actually get on the rivers with canoes and kayaks and discuss the interaction between really the water and not only surface water but groundwater also, and how that interacts. We are developing curriculum as a part of this effort, and those curriculum studies are online, and certainly groundwater is an emerging issue in the Red River Basin that we're going to be looking at.
That is important to hear, because if I don't expect you're going to have a drought this year, but parts of Minnesota are. So I think that would be an important thing for students, because the good science mm-hmm. tells the relationship between both. Any other questions from members? Representative Kahn.
I just wanted to make a comment. This is, first of all, is this in the Clean Water Council's bill at this moment?
No.
No. Okay, let me make a comment. This is the kind of programs that I'm looking for to give the highest priority to, in terms of the sense that it's matching local funding, it's involving kids, and it's early kind of science education, which will hopefully push them into scientific, well, show them the possibilities of scientific careers. So this does, and, you know, and in terms of the connectivity of all those things in this program, this just looks absolutely superb. So doesn't mean we're going to fund it, but I mean, it does look. This
Thank
is
you.
In terms
Thank
of the things that I've been talking about, the directions I want to go in, that this yeah. leads dramatically in that direction. So thanks a lot for bringing it to us.
Madam Chair and members, if I could just add one thing real quick. I mean, I appreciate those comments. And I didn't mention that, yeah, these monies are matched with a cash contribution from the Red River Watershed Management Board. But I also must say that the partnerships that Riverwatch relies upon, not only at all of the state agency levels with the DNR, the PCA, the Minnesota Department of Ag, Minnesota Department of Health, but also with the local SWCDs and the counties, not to mention the watershed districts. This is a program that truly has a comprehensive partnership base that we rely on, and it's, you know, I get to... I've been doing water stuff in the Red River Basin for 20 years, and if somebody was going to ask me what I was going to spend a dollar on, I'd spend it on this.
Well, I think it's Representative Coffey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, too, would say this seems like an outstanding program, and perhaps other watershed districts would be interested in emulating it, to copying it, so I appreciate the opportunity to hear about this. I'm just wondering if you've done a study at all about the in-kind donation that you're getting from the students and what that kind of value is.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we've talked about doing an in-kind study. Certainly the students and teachers, and we have over the years when this program, even before it was a part of the Institute, when it was being run by the Red River Watershed Management Board, they did do in-kind studies, and it is considerable. Mm-hmm. Because all of these activities, I must say, are usually extracurricular activities. So the students are doing this after their regular school hours, as are the teachers. One of the key pieces to all of the 29 schools or the 30 schools now that we have, one of the key pieces is having a teacher that's engaged and willing to volunteer that time, and that's important. But no, we haven't, and that's a valid point.
When you talk about the monitoring, tell us what you exactly monitor for.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the Riverwatch teams, each school has a team, and it's comprised of anywhere from 5 to 15 students. They measure the physical characteristics of water, so it's temp, DO, conductivity, those types of things. They also do, there are some schools, not all of them, that are doing snow water equivalent monitoring. They do frost depth monitoring. They do snow depth monitoring. And then as a part of our efforts last year, we also included a macro invertebrate monitoring piece. Which basically you go out and you collect the critters that live in the stream, and you can make some assumptions based on what's living there, the health of the stream.
I think that is extremely helpful testimony and would be good as part, that we understand that that is part of the curriculum, that there is not just the physical aspects, right, but the biological aspects. I think that's important. We're going to educate, and we're going to have critical thinking. That's another piece of the of what students need. Just because the water's right temperature and looks okay doesn't mean that critters will live there. So that's great. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, we will. Oh, Representative Fabian, did you have a question?
Just more comment, Madam Chair. This is one of the programs that's in the school district that I used to be employed at, and I have a couple of friends who are very active in it, and it's very well received. So thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment echoing Representative Fabian. Lake of the Woods District has been monitoring the Rainy River for, I want to say, about 10 years now. So they've been doing that also.
Super. Well, I don't see any other questions, so Representative Keel moves that House File 968 be laid over for possible inclusion in the legacy bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Kahn, I understand you're going to do House File 819.
Yes. Madam Chairman and members, this is just really a technical amendments bill to the grant to the Legacy Fund program. This is required by the this TMDL grant program is required under the Federal Clean Water Act to address impaired water bodies, and the proposed changes, the current program provides grants for 50% of eligible costs, and the expanded eligibility up to $3 million to help municipalities implement wastewater and stormwater. The proposed changes will expand the eligibility criteria to include all projects where municipalities are required. This bill has passed the Environment and Natural Resources Policy and has also passed the State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs Committee. And it's Mary Murphy's bill, but I think I can answer questions on it if there are any.
Thank you. And I see there's somebody here who's willing to answer questions. Representative Kahn, one of the questions we have received repeatedly is on the small community wastewater treatment program that in some instances it might be best to buy out the property rather than to put a new system in. Is that something that has been considered?
I'm not sure. Let's get someone who knows something about it to say things.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Freeman, the director of the Public Facilities Authority. The changes to the small community program in this bill do not include any kind of buyout. The small community program focuses on the very small unsewered communities, 20 to 30 households, or a lot of times less than that, that have oftentimes straight pipe raw sewage discharges. So there's some serious public health problems in addition to the environmental problems. Those small communities pose some challenges to find a solution that will fix the problem and also be something that the community can afford. The changes that we make here are increasing the technical assistance grant a little bit. From right now, there's a technical assistance grant that's capped at $40,000. We would like to increase that to $60,000, yeah, and also make counties eligible to receive some of those funds, because we found that's a successful model way to help these communities. It also makes some changes to the construction funding, increases the cap to $2 million on the construction side, changes the those are 1% loans, and there's right now grants available when the community has below average income. What we'd like to do is change that grant formula to match our wastewater infrastructure fund, which is for the bigger cities, which is a per household affordability criteria. So basically the grant kind of would be a level playing field. We have talked that there may be some situations where there just isn't, we just can't find a feasible solution that's also affordable. And so in terms of kind of thinking outside the box, we've noodled around about, could you do something similar to buying out homes in a floodplain, perhaps doing it on a voluntary basis and then dealing with people that didn't want to take that option with withholding tanks or something. But none of that is in this bill. That's sort of, we've been thinking about how do we, because as I said, these are challenging, really challenging small communities. We've had some success. We've built, I think, about a half dozen systems now in some very small communities, and they've been successful. But we have others on the list that are still posing a challenge. So
the question about housing and floodplains that are financially challenging, I think we need to have some more discussion about that. That's we've had lots of discussions about, are we doing well by the people who live there and by the taxpayers? So I wish you did have a more specific proposal for voluntary buyouts in floodplains. Anybody else have any questions on that? Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe one of the things we could do is put some language that asks for the development of that in this bill. You know, not applying it, obviously, to these set of grants, but this is an ongoing project, and so an ongoing, continually ongoing, so next year, make that one of the criteria that we want to look at.
That sounds like a reasonable idea. Would you think that that's a reasonable idea?
Yes, Madam Chair, we'd certainly be willing to work with members on some ideas on how to do that.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, the small towns, it gets very expensive for them to upgrade. Do any of them, or do you have any examples of towns going together, piping theirs to a nearby bigger city so they can utilize a larger, more efficient treatment plant?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that's oftentimes a good solution, and that's, we've done that in many situations. Running pipe, you know, there's, and of course it depends on what kind of, whether it's rock or sandy soil or what you're laying the pipe in. But when you get, you know, start to get several miles away, then that becomes a very expensive situation also. And it really does come down to economy of scale and the number of households that are available to sort of pay the bill, because we look at, of course, not only the The debt service, most of the money is still low-interest loans. So there are some grants, but mostly loans. So there's the debt service cost, and then there's the operation and maintenance cost. And the two of those together oftentimes for a small community can be $60, $70, $80 a month per household or more. So it gets up to the point where, it's in some communities, it's just not acceptable. We've done a lot of projects that are willing to pay that and have, but it doesn't work for everybody, and there's definitely communities where that just wouldn't be possible.
I don't see any other questions. Representative Kahn moves to lay House File 819. Over for possible inclusion in the legacy bill. Thank you so much. And next we're going to have Representative Newton, who has two bills, 1439 and 1571, and I will move both of those bills for possible inclusion in the, I think that's the omnibus bill. Yes, that would be in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Shall I start with the House File 1439?
Excuse me for just a second, Representative Newton. If I could ask the page to hand out the B bill, we have the updated B bill, and we'll act on that as soon as Representative Newton has finished.
Yes, Madam Chair, House File 1439 is caps the cost of forestry activities on school trust lands that may be certified against the permanent school fund at 30%. This is very similar to what Washington State does. And Washington State, as I understand it, is the only other state in the United States that has a DNR-like agency that takes care of their school trust lands. Some background information on the school trust lands, but looking at the committee, I think most of the people here are familiar with this. And to hold my hand through this, I've asked Representative O'Driscoll to come down because I know he carried most of the water on the school trust lands issue in the previous legislative session. And so if there are technical questions or concerns, I know that Representative O'Driscoll will be happy to address them.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you for the opportunity to be able to be here. Maybe I will just give some background information and provide a little shading and color for folks as to where we've been at. Many of you are familiar, as Representative Newton said, with the school trust lands. When we became a state, part of the Enabling Act that allowed us to become a state required us to set aside one section of land in each of our townships. And a section of land measures 1 mile by 1 mile, containing 640 acres. And the best way to picture what that property is used for is I always use the Little House in the Prairie example. It's where the Ingalls girls went to the one-room schoolhouse, and that was on the school section property. And that was used to be able to raise crops or to do other things of a productive nature to raise money to pay for the school needs of the kids in that particular area. And Minnesota said, you know, the law says one section of land is good, and that's what we need to do for federal purposes. And Minnesota said, we're going to double down on that, and they actually set aside two sections of land. And over the course of the history of the state of Minnesota, some of those lands have been bought and sold and traded. And as a result of the sale of that property, a corpus has been created where money has been set aside in this fund that's managed by the State Board of Investment for the purpose of helping to supplement education funding here in the state of Minnesota. And we know that education is an important item that we all value, and this is a way for us to be able to provide additional funds for education. As of the last official accounting on this, the funds were near $700 million of funds that were invested by the State Board of Investments and generates about $26 million a year in interest and dividends that are paid over and above general fund payments by the state of Minnesota to each of the school districts. And it's a $26 right now per pupil paid to each school district. And those funds, although when you take a district, say, of 1,000 students times $26, you say, well, $26,000 doesn't seem like a lot. But I can tell you that as of this date, no school district in the state of Minnesota has sent their check back to the state of Minnesota. They've all found ways to use that within the education process. And last year, through a very strong bipartisan effort in the House and in the Senate, a land trust commission to provide guidance on the management and oversight of these school trust lands was passed into law and is underway as a commission. And the purpose for that is to work with the DNR and work with others on these special set-aside lands that are to be held in trust for the benefit of the school students here in the state of Minnesota. There remains about 2.5 million acres of property. The goal is to continue to use those, as the Constitution calls, to be in a productive nature, to continue to fund money for education through this corpus that's growing and building over the years. And the idea is that we will continue to do this with sound environmental practices and sound marketing practices as well. The Constitution is somewhat vague on how to do this. It just simply says they need to be managed in a way that they're going to be productive for the school students here in the state of Minnesota. And Bill 1439 is an attempt to raise the level of awareness of some of the costs associated with the management of these school trust lands. And as Representative Newton's bill calls for, I'm trying to put somewhat of a cap on the costs associated with the management of those lands. They have varied from year to year, which makes it somewhat difficult to be able to plan in the long term of what those funds are going to be within the corpus of the School Trust Lands Fund. So just a quick little background here, five-minute overview on something that's been over 150 years in the making here in the state of Minnesota.
Let me see if I can understand this correctly. If the school trust doesn't pay for the costs incurred from managing its land, then basically we're just asking the general fund to put money into the school trust land. Am I getting that correct?
Madam Chair, the assumption, I believe, is that 30% cap would leave enough money for the DNR to manage those funds. This is, as I understand it, what they do in the state of Washington, and they seem to operate very well under that.
And if there was a blowdown or whatever, and DNR's costs were above 30% of the revenue they earned, then where is the expectation that this money would come from?
Madam Chair, your assumption is correct that it would limit the expenses associated with the school trust lands to that 30%. The real genesis and purpose behind this bill is to raise the level of awareness of the costs associated with managing the school trust lands. And what we'd like to do from the School Trust Land Commission is partner with the House and the Senate at this level with the committee to help us to build more efficiencies from all aspects of where the DNR, who is currently managing trust lands from that standpoint, as well as other lands that are under the control of the state of Minnesota, to be able to get a little bit cleaner accounting, particularly when it comes to those trust lands, because of the nature of those lands and how they have to be accounted for according to the Constitution.
Well, I think we need to ask DNR about this, because it does strike me that perhaps the better solution would just be put more general fund money into education and less into DNR. And that's something we need to understand. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Driscoll, a little bit confused here. I thought we were kind of moving away from DNR management of these trust lands, and now we're back talking about limiting their financial take from this. So could you explain the direction we're going with the trust lands and the management and hiring separate people to oversee that?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, you're correct. The ultimate goal is that we would have sound management practices on this. The way that the bill passed the legislature was signed by the governor last year, it creates a separate director and some staffing positions to be able to advocate on behalf of the trust lands outside of the DNR. The day-to-day operations, managements, and decision-making about when should timber come to market, where should the mining leases be permitted, and the like, still rests in the hands of the DNR. Our hope is that through the Land Trust Commission, that the House and the Senate would be partnering to bring our fiduciary obligations under the Constitution in equal play and equal footing with the executive branch's duties where the DNR is. So it's sort of a middle ground type of arrangement that we found that those, because of the efficiencies that the DNR has right now, that we would do that and that we would then continue through the years and the efforts of the Commission to partner with all the legislative resources and the executive resources to do what ultimately is best for the kids as it relates to those lands.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, gentlemen, for bringing this. I hope I'm not going out into the Fabian weeds with my math here, but correct me if I'm wrong, that $26 million is generated every year from this, and 30% is now going to be set aside, $7.8 million, and there's 2.5 million acres, is that correct? So that's like $3 an acre.
Madam Chair?
Are we somewhere in the ballpark, or I think that's correct. Is that higher than the DNR average, lower than the DNR average? Is that ballpark with what the DNR does is there somebody from the DNR that can answer that?
Madam Chair, I probably could help with some of that.
Let's ask DNR to come down. That was a question for DNR. If somebody could answer that question. What the average cost of managing an acre, am I getting that right, Representative Erickson?
Yes, I just want to know if it's average, you know, or above or below, I just kind of like to know.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Dave Schuler. I'm the lands coordinator for the Division of Forestry of the Department of Natural Resources. Representative Erickson, could you repeat your question?
Is $3 an acre roughly about average for what the DNR spends per acre managing their forests, or is that a high figure? Is that a low figure? I'm just kind of wondering where we're at with that.
It's fairly close, Representative Erickson. We're more probably in a $4 to $5 per acre cost. To compare what we're doing here in Minnesota with what Washington State is doing, you have to consider that the timber in Washington State is much different. It's much more valuable. They have a longer growing season, so their trees grow faster. They're able to turn around the trees much faster. The figures that I have for Washington State is their annual revenues are about $52 million for about the same amount of acres of trust land as Minnesota, whereas Minnesota's revenue is around $10 to $11 million gross revenue. When you look at 30% of $52 million, you're looking somewhere in that $15 to $16 million range for costs. For timber management, and we're nowhere near that kind of cost here in Minnesota. Our costs are down around $6 to $7 million.
Would it be helpful, Representative Erickson, I know it would be helpful for me, if you would write these figures down and submit a memo to this committee and we will share it, answering Representative Erickson's question more precisely.
Thank you, Chairman.
Madam Chair. Thank you. Just one of the things that I failed to mention in my setup is that there's really two different broad categories of assets. There are financial assets, which are stocks, bonds, mutual funds that are under the management of the State Board of Investment. And then there are the natural resource assets, the coppers, the minerals, the timber, those types of things that are out there. The $26 million that I was referring to was the returns on the financial assets that are being paid out. And the idea is that on the natural resource assets, when they are sold, the minerals and the timber and the like, That's the portion that we're talking about, the asset, the expense control mechanism, so that more can go into that corpus so that we can have a higher payout on the financial assets that go to the school. So, Representative Erickson, I apologize if I wasn't clear on the two broad sets of assets that the fund or the trust lands and the permanent school trust lands make up.
I think the question remains, and we will get some numbers from DNR. So, any other folks want to testify for or against this? I don't see any others. So House File 1439 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And now on House File 1551, which I have moved.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Madam Chair, 1571 is a bill actually that I started 3 years ago, and we received some funding to do a pilot project that involved, at the time, 10 school districts. And the objective was to capture water coming off parking lots and buildings at school sites, and to have that water be collected in rain gardens that would be used for science labs, ecology, hydrology studies, the like. We, in fact, Director Jeske and I spoke at the Minnesota School Board Association to a group of superintendents regarding the fund. Somehow the funding was provided, but it never did get to the schools. And subsequent to that, Bruce Baumier, who used to be the chair of the environmental EQB board, Environmental Quality Board, I think it is, worked closely with Fridley School District and Medtronic, and got money from Medtronic to do this project at the Fridley School District. I mention that because 2 years ago we had a real heavy rain, and not a drop of water that came off the Fridley School parking lot or buildings ended up going into the stormwater sewer system. It was all contained and goes into the rain gardens, and they use that very successfully as a learning site for the schools. The funding that I'm asking for in this project will do this for Anoka County. I would like to make one oral amendment, and that's on line 1-9, is to take out the word educational so that we're not limited only to schools, but we can also do these projects at county libraries, city halls, and public parks. Also, keeping it within the educational framework so that it would be used as community education as opposed to a K-12 education alone type of facility. That's it in a nutshell. We're looking, you know, to do these as experiments to stop the rainwater runoff going into the storm system. And Chris Lord, our conservation district manager, just wanted me to point out Anoka County is the heart of the Anoka Sand Plain, which is the recharge area for the metro area aquifers. And projects that help turn stormwater runoff into groundwater through infiltration will help sustain our groundwater supplies. So it's an important area in the Anoka County Sand Plain.
Representative Newton, rain gardens have been money generally goes out in competitive grants, mm-hmm. And rain gardens, I think, have been generally seen as something that the grant money can be spent for. If I were you, I would leave the word educational in.
Okay.
Because there is a possibility that this money, as Representative Kahn has talked about, can be used as for education as well as the water. So I think just leaving it in might be a good idea.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'm content with that. That was a recommendation of Chris Lord from the Conservation District. But as you know, Anoka-Hennepin alone has some 50 buildings in our school district. And we have St. Francis, Spring Lake Park, Columbia Heights. So within Anoka County, there are plenty of school buildings where we can do these projects.
Any questions for Representative Newton? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed, Representative Newton, that Representative Kahn's bill, the Clean Water Legacy Bill, includes $3 million, $1.5 million in the first year, and $1.5 million in the second year for community partner grants to local units of government for things such as rainwater gardens. Specifically, rainwater gardens are mentioned. Is it your intent then to earmark part of that money, or is this to be money above and beyond that money?
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, to be honest with you, I don't know. I'm just hoping to get this project off the ground. We had tried 3 years ago, thought it was going, and the money disappeared somewhere along the way.
Representative McNamara, we have generally stuck to competitive grants in this area. We have not had a category, though, of educational institution or educational facilities for competitive grants, if that is your question.
Madam Chair, they clearly would qualify under this. This is a $3 million, the Clean Water Council and the Governor's recommendation for community partner grants to local units of government, which clearly could include school districts, I'm assuming, for things specifically structural vegetative management practices to reduce stormwater runoff. It goes on and on. I don't need to read it all. But practices including but not limited to rainwater garden and other vegetative infiltration basins. So it clearly is a program where, and it is a competitive grant program here.
Any other, Representative Kahn?
Well, just to answer Representative McNamara's question, I'm not really in favor of earmarking, but when we have a good idea coming up like the, you know, like the other one that we had for the Red River project, I don't mind putting the words in that kind of lead towards it, i.e. Things like local funding, involvement of student groups, you know, and that sort of thing. I prefer to, you know, like indirectly earmark it rather than directly earmark it. So if there's another better project that comes along and has those aspects in it, or it encourages more people to think along that line, but we'll see how it plays out. But that's my thought. I prefer not specific earmarking, but when we hear something that we think is the kind of thing we want, particularly other people to do, I like the idea of putting the words in that lead to it. We think is the kind of thing we want, particularly other people to do. I like the idea of putting the words in that lead to it. So.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And along those same lines, it's a great idea, but doing this for one county applying for this, we could have 86 other counties coming in here asking for the same thing. So I guess I'd rather see it come out of the larger appropriation, although you know, Anoka County has a lot of buildings and such. It's a large school district. But, you know, if this is a good thing, it should be available for all counties. And it may be out of that larger appropriation that Representative Kahn mentioned.
Well, you know, the thought is if something kind of becomes a demonstration, then we could expect it to go on in future years and more people. If other counties have, if this hasn't been done in the past with that large money in there, with that large sum of money in there, maybe we can do something that would encourage these kinds of proposals.
I think in our bonding bills, we are encouraging this kind of thing too. So, well,
it's a little.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, Representative Kahn, do we know of any other programs out there that have attempted to do this, and we've got some outcomes back from that and other?
This would be a competitive grant, yeah. So other people could, I mean, if you have competitive grants and there's a pot of money for competitive grants, there's no reason
I think that Representative Kahn and I are saying the same thing. If there's this pot of money, any school district can apply for it if that is language that it's for educational facilities.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. But I guess what I'm asking is has there been a program put in place in previous years that is doing this, and we've got...
I don't think so, but I sure don't know.
We certainly have rain gardens.
Yeah. So, you know, I think when you start talking about this, maybe people administering the Bowser can come tell us if they've known of any like this. And if they haven't, I certainly hadn't seen this River Watch. I hadn't seen anything like that before. But, you know, I don't know everything, so.
Okay. Thank you. I would renew the motion that Representative Newton's House File 1571 be laid over for possible inclusion in the legacy bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Okay. Representative Poppy, the B bill has been handed out, and would you like you to make a motion that this be laid over for possible inclusion in?
Yes.
I'm a little lost which bill right this minute. Either the omnibus bill or the legacy bill.
Yes, Madam Chair. Just this morning, as we had the bill before us, we actually had the bill as introduced, and it was amended in ag policy. And so this is the amended version. And what it does is actually request that the Commissioner of Natural Resources establish criteria for the honeybee habitat. And it makes things a little less of a mandate, but certainly we're trying to move this. The honeybee and pollinator habitat, we're trying to actually encourage that on public lands, and so that's what this bill is, and I would so move the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative McNamara?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Poppy. She did come and talk to me today. I appreciate that. And Representative Poppy, I'm just trying to understand. I don't serve on ag policy. On line 1.12 and continuing on to 1.13, it mentions whether to exclude native prairie or scient and SNAs. And I'm wondering if it would be better to say a list of suitable plantings, comma, and then to say what lands to include. And Madam Chair, I'm just asking, I would think we'd want the program to be inclusive. It just sounds better to me. It kind of leads people to believe that we're going to say we don't want any bees and SNAs, and I don't know if we necessarily would want to say that. There's some SNAs that would probably be great spots to have people put bees.
Representative McNamara, Representative Poppy and Representative Torkelson have brought up a real problem. It is my sense that there are going to be other opportunities to address this or other ways to address this besides the one in this bill. One of the things that, for example, we talked to Bowser this morning and asked if in their manual for restorations they looked at the issue of pollinators and whether there were going to be forbs available from early spring into fall, and Mr. Jaski said he did not know whether that was the case or not, and so he was going to check back with staff. If that is not the case, it may be a good thing for us to appropriate a small amount of money for that job to get done. So there might be other opportunities other than the one that is before us to get at the issue that has been brought up. I would actually hope there are multiple ways that we could deal with this issue. I truly believe it's a real one. One of the things Representative Torkelson and I talked about, and is not in here, is whether we should be having some folks come in and talk about the visit roadsides for wildlife, and we will do that. So there, I think there are more opportunities than the one in this bill. So, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I would just concur with Representative McNamara that the broader the language is in this bill, the better, and if it's acceptable to broaden that language, I would support that effort.
It would be fine with me if Representative Poppy. There might be a consensus to do that. We do have a 24-hour rule, but if there's consensus, we certainly can waive that rule.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, we're trying to get the right language, and certainly I'm open to any suggestions that people have about this. Just one comment, I guess. As I read it, the criteria would mean that we're including native prairies or scientific and natural resources or natural areas unless we decide to exclude it. So am I reading it differently, or is that... So it's saying it's inclusive unless we decide to exclude.
I know how to get it. Okay.
I appreciate any... comments and questions about it, but I just maybe I let's move ahead and get honeybees to be able to.
Representative Poppy moves her motion that House File 595 made over for possible consideration in either the legacy bill or the omnibus bill or both.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes.
All right, next on our agenda, Representative Hansen is not here. Is he here? Oh, Representative Hansen, you have House File 1423?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move.
Is that the one you're doing?
I move House File 1423 for possible inclusion in the Clean Water Bill, and I have multiple testifiers and handouts. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House File 1423 is a follow-up to legislation that was passed several years ago relating to the issue of coal tar. We have had in the past presentations about coal tar use and appearance of coal tar in our waterways. Since legislation was providing an incentive for local ordinances relating to coal tar, we have had some manufacturers that have withdrawn the use of coal tar from their products. The bill in front of you relates to use and sale prohibitions and provides money from the Clean Water Fund for outreach on the issue and enforcement. So with that, I have some testifiers.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Tiffany Forner, and I work for the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District, where I oversee the operations and maintenance of our district projects. The Watershed District supports this legislation because polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, known as PAHs, are found in coal tar sealants. And PAHs are toxic to the environment and human health because coal tar sealed surfaces, when they break down, when stormwater runs across them, then the PAHs then run into our stormwater ponds and accumulate in the stormwater sediment. The Watershed District has been actively maintaining our stormwater ponds and is finding that PAHs are accumulating in our stormwater ponds around the metro. For example, last year we dredged three ponds in our watershed, and all three were contaminated with PAHs. What the PAHs do is they increase the maintenance dredging cost by actually doubling the overall cost to perform the maintenance. For example, last year we dredged the stormwater pond on the southwest side of Lake Calhoun, and if the sediment had been contaminated, it would have cost around $40,000 to get rid of the sediment. But since it was contaminated, it cost around $80,000. And the reason that it costs more is that the PCA requires the contaminated sediment to be disposed of at a permitted landfill facility because of the contamination. In 2009, the state banned the use of coal tar products by state agencies. And this last fall, the Minnesota Association of Watershed Districts passed a resolution in support of extending that ban statewide. Because there are alternative products that are available at similar costs, The Watershed District encourages you to support a statewide ban on coal tar use. Thank you for your time.
Madam Chair, I am Eric Evenson. I'm the administrator of the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District. Again, I just to reemphasize the impact to our communities caused by PAHs, in addition to the health issues associated with them, both human health and aquatic life. It's expensive. It has literally doubled the costs of cleaning out stormwater ponds in the metro area. Well, statewide. Ms. Forner indicated, 5 years ago when we first cleaned out the Calhoun Ponds is a stormwater pond. It treats about 800 acres draining into Lake Calhoun. 5 years ago, clean out the pond, it cost us right around $60,000. Last year, it cost us $122,000 for the same pond. We have thousands of ponds across our watershed district, thousands across the state of Minnesota. This is adding considerably to the cost of maintenance. 28 cities across Minnesota have already adopted bans on PAHs, including White Bear Lake, Inver Grove Heights, the city of Minneapolis, Shorewood, and several others have adopted this. Other states, at least one other state that I know of, has adopted a ban, the state of Washington, on the use of coal tar sealants. So again, what we're looking at is a very, it's very expensive for us to manage these ponds with these sealants in the ponds. And there are viable alternatives available, commercially available, that cost about the same. So the impact to the homeowner should be is really negligible. But the impact to the property taxpayer is significant. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, have other states enacted a ban like this? And could you give us some examples of products that would be used? Because on line 2.10, there's an exemption for if a product is not available, an alternative product. So that's an exemption. So can you give us some examples of what some of those products could be?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I believe we have the Pollution Control Agency here that can talk a little bit about some of the issues relating to regulation on that. I believe Mr. Evenson just mentioned that Washington, there is a statewide ban there. There are products that have changed over time. You have resurfacing of driveways is one example, and there's a prominent company that does that has removed coal tar from their material doing that, you know, and you may
Representative Hansen, can you speak closer into the mic?
An example would be, let's say you have a driveway to your house and you are resurfacing that. There's a major company in the South Metro who has removed coal tar from their product line where they're doing that. They're still doing the resurfacing, but they do not include coal tar. My understanding, there are maybe five companies. I had some information from the Chamber of Commerce that there are some issues where coal tar may be used in certain areas where there's a lot of petroleum products that are used to help have the paving be more resilient. We can get some more information on that if you'd like. Madam Chair, I believe there are the cities and maybe some other testifiers as well.
Thank you for coming.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Birch. I'm the City Engineer and the Public Works Director for the City of White Bear Lake. We were the first city in the state to initiate and adopt an ordinance that restricted or prohibited coal tar product use for driveway sealants. I'm here to tell you that every place I go, other city engineers, public works directors, when I go to meetings, come to me and say, okay, how's that working? How much effort did it take to get the ordinance adopted and passed? And a lot of them are saying, okay, that's great. We'd like to do that. There's a lot of effort there. We've got other things going on. How soon will the state be adopting this ordinance? Because it makes so much sense. Everything that the previous witnesses testified to is right on. But the things that we're finding in White Bear Lake is that it costs at least twice, sometimes on, depending on the project, it costs three times as much to remove and dispose of the sediments of these stormwater ponds that are contaminated with PAHs. I'd encourage you to seriously consider adopting a statewide ban. I think it would save a lot of cities a lot of time. It makes sense from all of the issues that were brought up here in previous testimony. It just makes a lot of sense, and there's a lot of cities sitting back waiting for the state to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. The League does support a statewide ban on coal tar sealants. When this was initially enacted, we actually suggested that there needed to be a study done and that we hold off on doing a statewide ban while we looked at how frequently is coal tar what is required to use on a given surface and how widely is it used. We found it is not used on any transportation surfaces and that, in fact, there is a completely replaceable alternative that does not contain the coal tar levels that are causing the problems in our stormwater ponds. Meanwhile, as our stormwater ponds are being more and more regulated under state stormwater permitting and our cities are literally being given orders to start cleaning out their ponds, this is becoming a higher and higher concern. And so we do support this being done at a statewide level. The science is there to support that. And had a number of cities contact me just today when they saw the bill up asking that I express that that's a continuing concern that they have and a rapidly escalating costs that they have that can be addressed with a fairly straightforward action. Happy to answer any questions, Madam.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen or Mr. Birch, do you know how much a percentage today of the seal coating that's done uses coal tar, either in municipal work, I guess, Mr. Birch, in the public sector? How many of the seal coating contractors that cities are hiring today use coal tar?
Madam Chair, members of the commission, the street seal coating that you see done on municipal streets, those products are, they've moved away from the coal tar products. What we're really interested in is the seal coats that are applied to driveways, which you go buy at Menards or Home Depot or local Ace. Those products that people apply to their driveways themselves, that's what we're really concerned with. The commercial applicators that do driveways, and we heard about that earlier a little bit, there's companies out there that do your driveways, and there's, everybody's heard of a ton of them. They are very good, and a lot of them are already starting to move away from the coal tar products, the ones that they'll come in and apply to your driveway. There are still companies that will do that outside of White Bear Lake and some other cities.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. That was my next question. Do any commercial applicators doing residential work still use it today?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, my understanding is there are some, and I can give you an example that I had last summer. I had a private property owner call me because there was a commercial applicator treating a driveway in his neighborhood. He was very concerned that that applicator was using a coal tar based product. So we went out and responded, and it turns out that he wasn't. But there are applicators out there that are still using the coal tar based products, but certainly we've banned them in White Bear Lake.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering, Madam Chair, are we going to hear from the PCA in regards to, I'm curious just if they were going to speak on some of the research the university's doing in regards to alternatives to the expense of hauling away of the sediment?
We'll be glad to hear
that. Yeah. Madam Chair, I may be able just to shed a little bit of light on that because we did, in White Bear Lake, a pilot project of one of the alternative means of disposing of the contaminated sediments under some money that was appropriated 2 years ago. We did a project in White Bear Lake where we excavated the sediments and stockpiled them on site. We built a berm on the site. We had a unique opportunity with the location of this particular stormwater pond. We were able to excavate the material there, construct a berm,
within some certain specifications. What that did was allow us to cut down our disposal costs, our trucking costs, and actually, really, the actual construction cost of doing this was much cheaper by doing it in the winter in the manner that we did it. So we did that at about a third of the cost of what it would cost us to excavate those sediments and haul them to a certified landfill. So that's just one example of what we did.
Would someone from PCA like to come up and chat with us?
Madam Chair, may I?
Certainly.
Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Greg Berquin. I work for Upper Midwest Seal Coat Manufacturing as a past applicator. I've applied coal tar sealant and all coal tars and asphalt emulsions that are available in the Upper Midwest region. I have extensive knowledge on both products that we're discussing here as one of the alternative asphalt emulsion and all the damaging effects that coal tar can.
Can you just hang on and spell your last name for us?
Spell? B-O-U-R-Q-U-I-N.
Thank you.
Berquin.
You may continue.
That being said, this whole process that we're looking to do and to ban coal tar, I highly advise that we do this for more than just environmental reasons and the watersheds that we're talking about here. Another issue that we haven't discussed is the asphalt preservation itself. Coal tar disintegrates and shrinks, which in turn will dry up the binder or the oil that's in asphalt and shorten the lifespan of asphalt. Whereas the asphalt emulsion is the same kind of oil that is in asphalt and will extend the life of asphalt by helping to replenish the asphalt, to rejuvenate it, so to speak. And I can go on and on about many things.
Let's see if there are questions for you. Questions for members? Representative Babian, did you have a question? I just can't tell.
Yes, I did, Madam Chair. It was for the gentleman from White Bear Lake, actually. I'm just curious to know about, so we've got these different things in place that prohibit the use of these. I'm wondering about penalties. What happens if somebody does mistakenly put it down?
Yep. Madam Chair, members of the Commission, we have an ordinance and we have a fine, a penalty that's built into our ordinance. And it's up to $1,000 for the penalty for that. So it can be, you know, gradual depending on the situation, I guess. So that's how our ordinance reads, and how you would take care of that. You know, if the emulsion, or not the emulsion, but if the coal tar product were applied on a driveway, it's a difficult thing to remove. You'd almost have to mill it off or remove the driveway to remove it if it were applied mistakenly. We're finding in White Bear Lake that we've got really good support from all of our local vendors, you know, the Menards, the Aces, the Home Depots. Those kind of local merchants really took that material off the shelf because there was other products available. And we also found that some of the local, that I've spoken with anyway, some of the local commercial applicators have also adopted to other products. So we're getting a pretty good compliance in White Bear Lake. We're also getting an awareness of the public, which is interesting. I told you earlier about the resident that called me. I also had another applicator call me last summer on a project. We have a boundary that's irregular with the White Bear Township, and there was a big project that they did on there to seal all of their trails, their bituminous trails. I got a call about this time one night, and the guy just wild said, "You guys are using coal tar?" And I said, "Where?" And I couldn't imagine where he was talking about, because we didn't have a project going on. Well, after I figured out where he was in the township. We have an inner boundary there. But I did call the township, and they talked to the contractor that did that work, and it was not using coal tar. So the awareness is really up there, both in the public, we think, and also in the applicators.
Okay.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then one of the other concerns I have is for merchants, particularly in my part of the state, who may have inventory left. The date of enactment I see is January 1st of 2014. Are they going to be stuck with the cost of inventory if they haven't sold the product by then?
Representative Hansen, do you want to address that?
Madam Chair, I specifically provided for the January 1st rather than the traditional August 1st that would provide, that's a concern of having those existing inventories. So I've put an extended period out.
Did anybody else have any questions? Representative Anderson, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the obvious question is, if the cost is about the same for the coal tar product and the alternative product lasts longer and is better, why would anybody use the coal tar product?
Still remains to be seen. I can't figure it out. It's been used since, Madam Chairman, it's been used since the 1950s. And really the emulsion started coming around in the 70s as an alternative. West Coast, they've been using it for 30 years successfully. The misconception is how long does it last on top? And that's what most of the homeowners, business owners are looking at. How long does it last on top? Well, that's not the question, really, because it deteriorates the pavement. It doesn't make it last the 25 years that we're looking for. The real question is how long can we preserve the asphalt? And let's use a product that is conducive to that, so to speak. They we'd never made it until the 70s, so it's just been something that the three or the four manufacturers now up here in Minnesota just are used to making. And then trying to make an emulsion has been trial and error until the last 10 years. We've gotten recipes that are better, adding additives, which will make the product comparable to the coal tar as far as making it last on top, so to speak. But that's not what we're looking for, to make it last on top. There's so many more, like she said, the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, the aquatic life food chain, but really overall preservation of the asphalt in general. So I think education is what we're looking for, and that's what I try to do with our customers, is educate them, and the end user as well, the business owner, the homeowner. And so it's just a matter of educating people that an emulsion is truly a better product for the asphalt. Without all the damaging effects of the watersheds, the aquatic life, all the way up.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quickly, and this is more of a general question about stormwater pond cleanout. Are those sediments tested every time a pond is cleaned out? And how long is this residual effect of coal tar contamination going to be with us?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, when we do storm pond sediment cleanouts, we test the sediments. If it's going to be over a certain threshold, 3,000 yards, we're required to do testing. The testing is fairly expensive. So in White Bear, we've tested a variety of our ponds, so we know where the coal tar products are, where the pHs are in those ponds. How long are they going to be there? We don't know, because there's a lot of research being done at the University of Minnesota. There's a lot of research being done by other groups trying to figure out the life of these. The project that I told you about earlier, the pilot project that White Bear Lake undertook, we call our Varney Lake project. We are undergoing a series of tests on that. We have an ongoing testing program for the next 3 years to test water samples that come through that berm there to see if pHs are traveling or if they're staying attached to the sand particles that are the sediment particles that they're attached to when we excavate them from the pond. We think that they will be, based on some research that's been done at the University of Minnesota, we think that those particles will stay attached quite rigidly to those individual sediment particles. They tried rinsing them with water for a long period of time. They tried rinsing them with solvents for a long period of time before they were able to loosen those particles. So we think that in a wet environment, which is where they are when we get them out of the bottom of a sediment pond, they're going to stay attached to those mm-hmm. particles. So we're reasonably confident that this Varney Lake project will be successful, that the particles will stay there. But they will still be polysilica aromatic hydrocarbons. That's what they'll be. And I don't know how long they'll be in that state, maybe indefinitely.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there other compounds that require special disposal of these sediments?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, and I can defer to other people that are here, but there are other things that are of concern. The PAHs that we've been tackling are one thing that we've been able to identify, and that's why we went after them, because there are other contaminants out there, yes, that's the answer to your question. But PAHs we were able to identify for sure, and that's why we want those banned. We can stop PAHs from getting into these storm ponds. Then once we've done the pond project like they've done, and you come back and do it 5 years from now or 10 years from now when you have to do it again, hopefully you won't have to handle those sediments in a special manner and haul them to these special landfills. You can dispose of them in a different manner where you can use them on a project site. So that'll cut down the cost in the future. So the sooner we can take those out of the waste stream, the better we're going to be for the long term.
Okay. Representative Hansen, do you have other witnesses, or is this it?
Well, Madam Chair, I think the Pollution Control Agency is here, and there might have been a question. I would like to just get them on the record for their opinion.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Adalco with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'll be brief in my testimony here because we echo what you have heard before here. The MPCA does support a statewide ban of the product. So for the same reasons I expressed before, the cost of when it does go into stormwater and other considerations. So I'd like to just highlight some things that were asked and get answers to those questions. There was a question here regarding studies on how to dispose of them. MPCA has been working with the City of White Bear Lake on an alternative disposal system. That project's going to take place through the spring of 2014, and we hope that that may be another option. We've also assembled a work group previously to look at other alternative treatments. They hired an independent contractor, and the work group, along with the independent consultant, reported again recommending landfilling as the preferable alternative. The University of Minnesota also submitted a report to the MPCA regarding whether or not we could use a sediment for composting yard waste under certain controlled situations to see if there were other ways. And again, that report concluded that composting is not a feasible treatment option. At this point, we are still looking at ways, but at this point we have not found any alternatives. Now, second question was regarding the stock and the date here on the bill being out to 2014. We've been doing a lot of work with retailers to find out and try to talk to them about the product and move them away from using it. We've found out that they have about 1 year stock in their stores. So this date would help. It would allow them to sell out this year, and then they wouldn't have anything for the next year when they come back up for the season. So this would help make sure that we do have retailers get rid of their stock and that they're not facing undue hardship. With that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Well, Representative Hansen, this committee has jurisdiction over the dollar, and I have wanted you all to hear about the issue because of the cost to us. We cannot do the ban in this committee without having gone through a couple of other committees. However, we can lay over the part of the bill, the money part of the bill, which I will do, or I will ask you if you would like to have the dollar laid over for possible inclusion.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would like that to happen.
Okay. So House File 1423, the dollar amount will be laid over for possible inclusion, and I think it's been a good education for us about what is costing our communities in cleanup costs, because we're obviously going to be dealing with this issue again. Members, we've been doing really well. We have three bills left, House File 2423, 1277, 737, and 1530. If you would keep everything in your folders, we are going to move rooms, and just so people will have a chance for dinner, we will resume at 6:10.
Madam Chair, just before we do the shuffle, having reviewed the minutes from the previous two meetings, I would move their adoption.
Representative Falk has moved the adoption of the minutes from the previous two meetings. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
No? Minutes are adopted. Members, we will be in recess. We are moving room, and we will come back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think we're going to move House File 737 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill.
Representative Hansen moves House File 737 for possible inclusion in the Finance Bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House File 737 is the Omnibus PCA Technical Bill. And it has been through several committees. Mr. Kadelka is here if anybody has any questions.
Would you like to quickly tell us what's in the bill?
Sure. Madam Chair and committee members, for the record.
Quickly is the operative word there.
My name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. As the author mentioned, this is the MPCA's policy bill for the year. There are three parts to it. Some are small policy changes. One is with the Clean Water Fund. Currently, because of the number of pieces of information we need to get on clean water projects, we do put those in our contracts with various parties that we do work with. In the case of the federal government, it's much more difficult to rewrite a new contract with the feds. It has to go back to D.C. to get approval. What we'd like to do is authorize our use of using their generic contracts. We would still meet the needs that are required on Clean Water Legacy Act projects. We would just not work them into the contract. They will be providing the information to us through other means, including FDEs. That's what Section 1 of the bill does. The other piece deals with the petroleum environmental covenants. Currently under law, our voluntary investigation and cleanup program, along with the Superfund program, has the ability to secure environmental covenants to make sure cleanups are done correctly and protective measures are there. There was some discussion and concern about this part of the bill in environment policy. Since then, we've worked with all the stakeholders and have achieved peace in the valley on the piece. We know of no opposition. The other parts of the bill are changing some reports, reducing the frequency of some reports that are could be done every other year, or at this point, we know that no one's reading them or they're a glorified fund statement, so we have just asked to repeal them. Another part of the bill is the repealer. It's every year the MPCA, along with any agency, has to do an obsolete rules report. And what we have done, identified a couple of those in the report, and we have in the repealer of this bill set out to get rid of them. The final two pieces in the bill are part of the governor's budget. One deals with wastewater lab certification. We are working currently, wastewater labs for quality assurance certification is done through the Department of Health, through their drinking water programs. As the Department of Health's drinking water program has grown and no longer is much bigger than the needs of those for wastewater labs, we are going to right-size government by taking back that portion to, we will still have a quality assurance program there. However, it will be less requirements for those labs to be certified and less cost. So this will be something that the specifically Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities and others have asked for to reduce their costs. Finally, Article 2 of the bill deals with sanitary districts. Currently, the formation, dissolution, or modification of any sanitary district, the administrative part is done with the MPCA. We are proposing, and we have worked with the Office of Administrative Hearing, to transfer that duty over to the Office of Administrative Hearing, since they have a municipal boundaries unit that is more familiar with this, and they are more capable of doing this. This is something we do maybe once every other year, where boundary changes are something that the Office of Administrative Hearings does frequently. And we have taken it from our statute, and you'll see the large number of repealers in Article 2, and put it into the Office of Administrative Hearings section of law, and made some slight updates. Madam Chair and Committee, that's the bill.
Questions, members? Otherwise, Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 737 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Oh, I got one more.
I know. But go for it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I would move House File 1277 for possible inclusion in the Clean Water Fund bill. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is, if you go back to our recent discussion on coal tar, what we're doing is kind of, with this shoreland bill, is kind of like what we were talking about had happened with coal tar, where we provide incentive grants to local units of government to do ordinances. And we're using the Clean Water Fund, and that's...
Members, Representative Hansen is fast tonight. Do you have questions for him? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, would this be part of some of the Bowser projects already in the Clean Water Fund, or would this be in addition to?
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, I received some input from the Department of Natural Resources that perhaps Bowser would be the better agency for distributing grants. After this is laid over, I'll be working with the Department of Natural Resources and the Board of Water and Soil Resources to discuss the appropriate entity for distributing dollars.
Representative Magler.
And then, Madam Chair, if I could ask again, would it be part of one of the current Bowser programs in the Clean Water bill that Representative Kahn is carrying, or would it be in replacing one of them?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I have not made any plans on where this would go. I'm distributing or presenting the bill as an idea, as an open appropriation in there, and wanted to have it heard to begin the conversation.
Representative McNamara, just as with all the other bills, we have heard about the Clean Water Bill, and we are now hearing from members who have ideas, and we will continue to do that with one more bill, I believe.
Madam Chair.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, again, Representative Kahn has $13 million in her bill on page 10, line 11, $6.5 million in each year to restore permanent conservation easement, riparian buffers adjacent. It seems like it's the Clean Water Council and the governor have kind of lined up with you, Representative Hansen, so I'm just wondering if this is going to be part of that or what it is. So thank you.
I would renew my motion, Madam Chair, to lay this over to possible.
Any other questions, members? Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File, which one are we on? 1277 be laid over for possible inclusion in the legacy bill. Thank you, Representative Hansen. We are in the last bill, and I believe Representative Hackbarth is going to move it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would move House File 1530 for consideration and possible held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Committee, for hearing 1530. This is a request from the Clean Water Fund for replacement of a bridge located near Isle, Minnesota. It's the Malone Island Bridge, and I've been innovative in my request in that this is a bridge that that crosses Lake Mille Lacs, and so I'm asking for an appropriation to the Department of Natural Resources in the form of a grant to the City of Isle to replace this bridge to protect the lake, to protect the adjacent creek, and the spawning areas from impairment. And I do have two handouts, if the page would be so kind, as to... Could you start with Madam Chair, please, so that she sees these? And Madam Chair, I have two testifiers with me. I'll start with Tim Corby, who's the city engineer, and he can reference both handouts that you're receiving. One member's is of the total cost as we projected it for this project. What's really important about the replacement of this bridge is that sewer and water lines are attached to this old wooden bridge. It's at least 50 years old, and you can see in the color photograph on both sides the situation, which engineer Tim Corby will explain to you. And as I mentioned in my appropriation request, there's a spawning area located near this bridge, and if those if that sewer pipe were to break, that would be devastating to Lake Mille Lacs, which you know is under siege anyway, because we have issues in regard to the walleye, and this little spawning ground near the bridge is a walleye spawning area. So with that, Madam Chair, with your indulgence, I'll ask Tim Corby, the city engineer, to testify.
Welcome, Mr. Corby.
Thank you, and Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much for allowing us to present in front of you today. Again, my name is Tim Corby. I'm the city engineer for the City of Isle, and again, thank you for your consideration of our bill. Our city has a major issue, and I'm kind of calling it a ticking time bomb. Essentially, the bridge that we have is the Malone Island Bridge. It's 50 years old. It's a wooden structure bridge. It was proposed to be replaced several years ago, and the city has not come up with the funds since 2007 when we identified it as a bridge that needs to be replaced. In addition, the sewer and water lines are attached to the bridge, and the attachment to the bridge, it has failed. Essentially, it's as you can see by the pictures, it is settled about 12 inches towards the lake. So 50 years ago, in the old days, they would just essentially strap these utilities to the bridge because there was no way to get underneath the creek. Again, this bridge is above Lake Mille Lacs. It's located in a very precious spawning area on Lake Mille Lacs. On the island, there are 60 residential properties that have 200 persons that live in those homes, most of them full-time. It's a quarter of the population of the City of Isle lives on the island. And the sewer and water, and also a gas line, I might add, is attached to that bridge. So again, we have two issues. It's a wooden bridge, 50 years old. It's in grave need of replacement. There's sewer, water, and gas lines are attached. And if you can see by the picture that was handed out, it's essentially encased in a wooden box. There are muskrats that live in that wooden box and is exposed to the elements. It's in desperate need of replacement. Our fear, and obviously the reason that we're here tonight, is because the support structure that was holding that sewer and water and gas line has failed. Our fear is that the sewer and water line will break and fall into Lake Mille Lacs, whereby allowing untreated wastewater to spew into Lake Mille Lacs. That's kind of why I referred to it at the beginning as a ticking time bomb. I would estimate it has months and not years that this support will last. And so that's why we're sort of here, I would say in desperation, asking that this bill be pushed forward and your consideration of funding this project. With that, we also bring up with today one of the council members, Council Member Linda Dolan, and I'd like her to also speak on behalf of the city.
Thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, I don't personally live on Malone Island, so
Could you put your name in for the record?
Linda Dahlen, D-A-H-L-E-N.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm on the city council. I don't live on Malone Island myself, so I really don't have a personal interest, but a number of people I know and friends live there. And I have been a member of the community for a number of years, property owner since the late 90s. And when I saw, and I run over that bridge sometimes, and when you see the condition of it, and you see how the ground heaves in the spring and in the, you know, with the ice and stuff. When he says there's imminent disaster, it's really true. It's moved about 6 inches in the last 2 years. The citizens are concerned not only, of course, it's very grave that the utilities of sewer and water, and I think a gas line goes through there as well. But also, a lot of the economy in the south end of the lake, as you know, is they're resort owners. They rely on the lake being healthy. And with all the changes with the fish and everything, they're scrambling to keep the area alive, really relies on tourism. If that thing broke and our fishing was condemned, it would probably be 2 years, and it would just devastate our economy. And while I'm not a lifetime resident of Isle, I love the town, and I call it my hometown. And I would really implore that we could get funding to get it fixed, keep our community safe.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Yeah, it seems to be a pretty precarious situation. But I have to ask, if the support is broken, has it been shored up temporarily, or are you just kind of just waiting for it to go?
It has not been shored up, no. No, it's. I can't say we're waiting for it to go, but we're hoping to get funding through your committee to fix it yet this summer. The plans and specifications have been completed. The city has stepped forward and completed the preliminary planning, but a community of 800, it's a difficult project to fund. And so we're looking for a source of funding to complete this project. Again, the city has completed the plans and specifications. We could go to construction yet this summer, so we're ready to start construction. Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Just a quick question for Representative Erickson. My question is, wouldn't this be appropriate for the bonding bill?
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, I have sent it to four different committees. So there's a bonding request in, but I know from past practice of the last few years, a specific project like this is not looked upon kindly because it doesn't have, probably in the words of many, a statewide interest, but no, it is a bonding proposal. I also sent it to transportation in a form because it's a bridge, and to this committee for legacy dollars, and it's being considered not the bridge part, but the infrastructure part for public facilities authority financing. So I'm looking at multiple places to find a little help. The committee, you know, Mille Lacs County is going to help us a little bit. I think they could probably afford $300,000. So I have actually requested a very, you know, top amount. But considering the fact that this is going to take considerable work to replace this wooden bridge with another structure, I decided to put in the top a number. You will see on the other handout that I provided you with the construction costs figured by Engineer Corby come to $854,000, and then the contingency $80,000, the legal fees $26,000, and the engineering $140,000, and that does not include the infrastructure costs for the sewer, water, and gas lines. So that brings us over $1 million, which a small city like Isle, where Representative Hackbarth used to have a cabin, cannot afford to do this without some kind of assistance. So knowing that the Clean Water Fund of the Legacy is intended to help keep our waters clean, I think this is a viable project to consider.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification, I was wondering where the under $300,000 was coming from, but that's the county. So it sounds like the city is doing the planning and the utilities. Is that right? And is there anything else the city would need to put into this project?
Well, Madam Chair and committee members, mm-hmm. Yes, you're correct. The city has completed the planning portion of this project. The plans and specifications are actually sitting in my briefcase, so they're prepared to do the construction yet this year, so you're correct.
And can you give me a dollar figure on what that was? I'm curious of what the investment of the city is. I realize it's a small town. So what's the investment in that planning? And also then, I believe Representative Erickson mentioned the utilities. So I'm guessing that the city is going to be funding the utility structures.
Madam Chair, committee members, yes, the city has expended approximately $80,000 to complete the construction drawings thus far. I've estimated to do directional boring, which is the new technology, obviously probably not new to this committee, but 50 years ago, we didn't do a directional boring, so we can actually now bore underneath the creeks, as the committee is well aware of. So I've estimated that at approximately a construction cost of $500,000, and we are proposing to go to PFA for that money. Public facilities.
Members. Representative
Backbar. Oh, well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I did own a little house in the city of Isle on Lake Street on Isle Bay, and I looked right up my dock right straight across to this bridge, and I've actually traveled under the bridge more than I've traveled over the bridge in my boat. And just about every time I've ever been under that bridge, I've thought about the sewer pipes and the water pipes and the gas lines that run under there. And it's just an old rickety bridge. If that thing ever falls down, we're going to have a disaster on that lake. So I've thought about it many, many times over the years. I had my little place there for 26 years, and I miss it dearly. Mm-hmm. But actually, the taxes got way out of hand. But I couldn't afford to live there or have it anymore. But this bridge definitely needs to be replaced. I mean, it's a disaster waiting to happen.
Madam Chair. And committee members, I wanted to add too, I understand that it doesn't seem like it's a statewide issue, it's more of a little local issue. I will share that I discovered this area up at Mille Lacs, and I was from the cities my whole life, and I fell in love with it by going up there back and forth hunting, boating, and everything with my kids and my family. So we are one of the biggest draws as far as next to the cities. It's only an hour and a half away from the North Metro Rim. And our little town of 800 explodes to tens of thousands on the south end of the lake for people that come up just for a day because we're so close, or for a weekend, or for a week. So I think we really do have a statewide impact from all directions that flock to our lake.
I don't see any other questions, members. Hackbarth will move to renew his motion that 1530 be laid over for possible inclusion in the legacy bill. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members,
I think you're good. I think we have finished our agenda for today, and with that, we are adjourned.